Standby, observers.
Standing by, sir.
Camera 8.
Camera 8 on, sir.
Switch to camera 5.
Camera 5 on, sir.
Camera 13.
Camera 13 on, sir.
Get that mouse down! Get it down!
Yes, sir.
Get him closer. Get him as close as you can. Who can he be signaling to?
We'll find out.
Radar!
Anything?
No, sir. Not at sea.
There must be.
No, sir. There's no ship, sir.
There must be an aircraft, helicopter, something.
There's nothing, sir.
Under the sea. Submarine. Try the sonar.
No, sir. There's nothing coming through.
But he must be signaling to someone. At Morse. Did you get it?
Yes, sir.
What'd it say?
Barrel!
Patter cake, baker's man. Bake me a cake as fast as you can.
Must be a special code.
Here's your answer, sir.
Patter cake. This is what you put in.
And that's what came out, sir.
That it is a new code. And the computer's not programmed for it!
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 28th of March, 2025, at 5 past. Sorry for the slightly late start. Streaming live from the East Stone Studios in Bristol, another temple aport in Tampon Charlie's Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. By far the best thing to have around, really. You can listen in the car, all sorts of places, and you can easy with the app. You just press a little thing on it, and if there's an interview you want to hear the whole thing, you've heard a little clip on here. It does it all for you. That's available free from APK Pure and the Apple App Store, but not from the evil Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero trust agenda, bending our minds with distortions, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators, and hatchet jobs on the heroes. That's what they love to do. McCarthyite witch hunts, going after anyone like Jeremy Corbyn with a bit of influence who speaks up for humanity and against the rentiers. Or World War III. Those with eyes to see and ears to hear the so-called solutions to the multiplying crises, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, shall I carry on? The twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies are crafted to make every crisis worse. And the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's techno-behaviourist dark enlightenment, cowards and control freaks, they want us as slaves to their AI. Or maybe just dead. Meanwhile, the pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and the vampire queen Carmilla are waging war on the British people as well as on China, Russia and the BRICS through energy saboteur-in-chief Ed Miliband. But anyway, it's not the end of the world. Or is it? As we learn, you learn. So helping us navigate the WEF's Fourth Reich matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And we're also joined by local activist and former Labour Party member Mal Sainsbury. In part one, we'll be having a listen to Crispin Flintoff talking about the effects of casualisation in the workplace since the 1980s. And in part two, Stephen Dorrell will be doing a review of Mark Felton, who is looking at Clockwork Orange. We've also got, of course, all the main international stories of the week. The Iranian and Russian news has been censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel. We want to hear what they've got to say. We can make our own minds up then, can't we? And us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia. But not off here yet. thank goodness. So anyway, we'll start this week, I think, with Mal Sainsbury. I'd just like you, if you could just do a little bit of an introduction of yourself, because as an activist, you've been quite busy on these social justice issues for a long time, haven't you? And I know we got to a stage in the 1970s where almost much of what people had been fighting for since the Second World War had been brought about. So many, there were hardly any people actually homeless. The mentally ill population, they were being looked after too. There were all sorts of problems, but most of the main ones, we'd nip them in the bud. So what were you up to back in those days?
Well, in the 70s, my major interest was housing, and we fought for the 1977 Rent Act, which eventually came about. And I have to say that having won so many things, I was in part of something called the Bristol Housing Action Group. We used to set up squats and put on the facilities for people. And we actually occupied an office block and got national coverage for that for 10 days. And we got an office block planning freeze for 2 years, and we really raised the whole issue. 77 Rent Act came through. And I have to say that from that time, we have now lost every single security of tenure, rent regulation, everything that we fought for.
So why were you occupying an office block?
It was a fantastic stunt to kind of like raise awareness of what was happening in Bristol. I mean,
but what was the point? You know, because surely this, you can't really use an office block for housing people, can you?
No, you can't. But there were so many office blocks going up, and now we've got different situation in Bristol where this what's it called, purpose built student accommodation is going up, which is far outstripping all the needs of the local people. Is it 22,000 people on the waiting list at the moment?
That's right. Yeah,
it's roughly, absolutely yeah. Dire. We have the most terrible housing crisis at present, and in the big cities. And Bristol is second only to London with expense, for instance. We have the most outrageous rents now, which mean that young people especially, we always used to say you shouldn't spend more than about a third of your income, whatever that income was, on rent. And now people are spending 50, 60, 70, 80%. They haven't got enough money to pay the bills and live.
Well, sounds like fun, occupying an office building, was it?
It was fantastic fun. We kept it for, and we had all the media outside, and we had concerts, and we had speeches, and we spoke to the national press, and we told them about all the issues that we were fighting for, and it really did hit home.
So
it was
where
fantastic.
Was this office? Is the office still there? Is it gone now? Whereabouts?
No, it's still
in
there.
Town,
it's
was
down,
it?
It was in Redcliffe. So we're talking about, well, it was mid-70s it would be. You could find it probably on the internet. But we made quite a big noise.
Is it
we
on Redcliffe Hill near the, it's
near
almost
Bristol
like the
Bridge.
Sort of... Oh, okay, yeah.
But we had, we joined our voices. We were the Clifton Tenants Association, Redland Tenants Association. In the days, it was sort of Rackman days. You know, when your landlady could complain about the colour of your curtains or the amount of visitors you had because of the wear and tear on your toilet and all sorts of nonsense. And people lived in terrible conditions, really properly slum conditions, because we didn't have, you know, all the rights that we have. And being an activist, I call myself a granarchist because I'm so old now, but being an activist, I just feel as if it's so important to keep our voice. And in this current day and age, my greatest bone of contention has been, you know, the Kill the Bill thing, that about trying to stop people actually having the right to protest, which is one of the most dangerous things I've ever heard of, really.
Well, the Kill the Bill is also, it has echoes from the 1990s and the Criminal Justice Bill. I can remember going on, I mean, enormous march. Hundreds of thousands of people in central London are marching against, and I think they had this sort of a sound system on a truck at the front, and they were saying, we want the right to party. You know, you're stopping the right to party, which is, you know, obviously that's part of all of this, you know, to have public space for people to do what they want to do without having to go through some sort of bureaucratic hoops to do it. If, so long as what they're doing is well organised, well run, and it's got some sort of things like they've organised some marshals or whatever, what on earth is the problem? And now we seem to have a much more authoritarian system where the police and the authorities insist on jumping through hoops for almost everything.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're losing that right to protest. And what's happened is the normalisation of this. So the young people, the angry young people, and I'm thinking of people in Bristol especially, because we've been a city always quite famous for its civil disobedience. And things that we've been doing in Bristol, from the rolling of the statue into there to the, you know, all the important things, have had ripples far, far from this city all over the world. So I feel as if we need to have those angry young people rising up again to assert their rights.
With the Kill the Bill, there's also this whole business involved in that bit of law from the Tory era about 4 years ago, where they're also saying that if you're found on a piece of land and you're reported by the landowner in a vehicle or a caravan with your family, doesn't matter who's there, that you're going to have your home impounded. So this is, I mean, it must hit home with any social justice campaigner around the world that to have someone who is on the margins of society to have their home then taken away as well. I mean, this is more than just trying to get someone off a piece of land where they're not wanted. This is the state saying you can't have a home.
Well, I mean, do you remember the Battle of the Beanfields all those years ago? And people's homes in the travelling communities, absolutely disgraceful how people's homes were destroyed. But
Well, they were all off to Stonehenge, weren't they? And they were stopped by the Wiltshire police and a whole bunch of other police on the way, diverted into a beanfield, told to stop, and then the police just went around smashing all the vehicles up.
Attacking everything.
And the people, yeah.
And the people, and the children. But I think if we have a look at today, and where are people supposed to live? We have this huge escalation of, which, you know, the local people don't like it at all, do they, in areas like the Downs, where I was passing it today and I saw it's risen from dozens to, I think there are hundreds of caravans, vehicles. You know, people need to be able to have a home and place to live. So what exactly is going to happen? Because we can't accommodate them in housing units. So I think alternative ways of living must be encouraged.
Well, I'm not sure if it's the same thing that you're involved with, but we still meet Bristol Housing Action every Monday, and we go through quite a lot of we see quite a lot of evictions taking place, particularly these common law evictions where they don't have to go through the court, the owner doesn't have to prove they own the place. Just a couple over the last few months. One is the tramway site, which had 100 or so vehicles there. It's completely hidden out of the way. It's an old tramway near Brislington on the way up to, on the A4 to Bath direction. Hundreds of people living there, absolutely not in anybody's way, completely invisible to the public. Another one was a site up at Lockleys, probably at least 100, maybe 150 caravans up there, which is the old gasworks site. So there are these old sites where people have been, but they're being slowly evicted, and people are ending up, a lot of them are ending up on the Downs, right out in the face of the public. So the council are not doing anything, it seems, to locate potential sites for caravans, mobile homes, vehicles, this sort of thing. They seem to be doing the opposite. Is anywhere where they are, where they're out of the way, where they're not causing, you know, they're not in anyone's face. I'm not saying they're causing trouble here. I mean, for example, they had, on both the sites I mentioned, they were having council bin lorries coming to pick up their bins every week, and so there was no problem with mass litter or anything like that. They seem to be doing the opposite, Mal. They seem to be saying, well, anywhere which is safe for travellers, the overflow of the population trying to live in Bristol, we're going to put you all on the Downs, right in everyone's face.
Well, I mean, they are doing the opposite. They should be absolutely making the sustainable lifestyles easier by providing facilities, water, toilets, rubbish collections. It all should be part of a public service, you know, because a lot of people, if you go and do interviews with people and you go and sort of talk to the actual people who are living, they live very, very low profile, sustainable lives. If you're living on a boat or in a van, I remember it being described once as if you, living in a finite world, if you live in a house, then you turn on the tap or you switch on a light, it's endless. But if you're on a boat or in a van, then something will break down or run out. So you therefore live in a much more sustainable way. So that, you know, this should be encouraged. And there are so many people now that, you know, they can't afford to live in a home. They can't buy a home. They can't rent a home. So I just want to know exactly, there are tents all over the place in all the parks. I mean, where are people supposed to live?
Well, there were a load of tents evicted from the Bear Pit in the centre a few weeks ago, a big hoo-ha in the press, you know, oh, we're getting rid of all the tents. And I walked past there during the week, there's another couple of them popped up again straight away. So it's almost like they're fighting a losing battle and they've got absolutely no strategy to deal with it. What would your strategy be?
I think I would set up a a system whereby that people could have much more choice about where and how they wanted to live, to be quite honest. And so I'd certainly have licensed sites, without a doubt, with all the facilities laid on. It's happened before in the past, and there are other facilities available in other cities.
Well, it's not rocket science. The council actually owns lots of land.
Yeah.
It's not rocket science to lay in, put up a shower block, maybe, put water in,
yeah.
Electricity points, that sort of thing. It seems to me really, really a sensible thing to do, particularly with, I mean, for example, right in the city centre here, in St. Paul's, there's an enormous site which is completely, is an old corrugated paper factory. And that was demolished and bought by social housing places for people. And that is probably, let's think about football fields, it's probably about 8 acres, maybe 6 acres, something.
The council owns a lot of land.
That isn't owned by the council, but there's no reason why it's been, one point I'm trying to make is it was been empty for nearly a decade now. And occasionally you see a circus tent go up on there for some people who are connected with the council. So you can stay there, that's fine. But these bits of land are just being completely unused. They're land banked by various organisations. The idea is, well, we'll buy this piece of land, we'll level it, and we'll watch the price go up, and then when we feel like it, we might build on it and we might sell it.
Yeah.
So that all that land is completely taken out of circulation by these people. Anyway, Martin, I just wonder if you could come in here, because we've got... what is it that's driving this, do you think? What's really driving the problem with housing and homelessness in the city?
Well, it's not just in Bristol, obviously, it's across the whole of the United Kingdom. Is the root of it, to my mind, goes back to the 1920s, when the Tory governments of the day wanted to create a Tory voting class of people who were homeowners. So basically those who were buying their own homes got mortgage tax relief, and they were encouraged to buy houses. Now, you'd say, well, that's not necessarily...
So is this instead of renting?
Instead of renting.
Well, I mean, yeah, and if you've got a house at the end of it, surely that's a bit of a tempting prospect, and that's
why there was a general consensus this possibly was okay. But, of course, the thing about it was it then distorts the market for land and housing, yeah? So you end up with a situation where... look at what happens with house prices in this country. They just go up and up and up during the boom.
Well, I mean, maybe it did start in the 1920s, but what I really want to get to is what's changed since the 70s, where, you know, people could get a place to live in the city, reasonable rent. In fact, the social housing providers had built pretty much as many houses as people needed to live here.
Well, after the Second World War, the massive creation of council housing then put a balance into that, yeah?
So what's changed since the 70s, though?
In the 70s, you started the process. I mean, that was the high point of what you might call government intervention in housing at that period. So lots of people did have, actually, decent council housing at that stage, which they hadn't had before. And there, of course, you're just dealing with, people on the margins who are still finding it difficult to get anywhere decent to live, especially younger people. But, of course, since then, there's been a counter-revolution. I mean, selling off council houses to existing tenants at less than they are than the actual property.
So yes,
worth,
this is sort of starting
a massive subsidy.
This is starting in the 1980s, isn't it?
Yeah.
With Margaret Thatcher saying that all these council houses, you can just buy your own council house now.
The right to buy. I mean, without being able to spend the income raised from that to building more homes,
it wasn't sold off at the actual. People were encouraged to buy, just like the nationalised industries, the shares were deliberately underpriced. Now, that means that all of the investment that's been put in by previous generations to build up public resources is then given away in one go to one lot of people.
So the idea is to try and turn these council house tenants into Tory voters.
That's what, and it worked. It worked. Because if people living in decent council housing when they were first built in the 1940s and 1950s, very grateful. And they did tend to vote Labour. And of course they could go on strike, for example, because their rent would not necessarily be called in and all this sort of stuff. Once you're at a home, this is, you know, quite conscious strategy of Tory strategists from decades ago. And of course they fulfilled their fantasy in the 1980s, but of course we're now living you know, in the 2020s with the consequences of this in terms of housing, in terms of not people not being able to get on the housing, any kind of housing at all, or on the housing ladder or whatever. And even Rachel Reeves and Starmer are only going on about we need more young people on the housing ladder as if that's the issue. I mean, well, what we need is decent places to live. But of course, I'll just quickly make this point. It also distorted the British economy so that people started investing in bricks and mortar and camps and skyscrapers and all the rest of it. And that's why we don't have what the Germans call a Mittelstand, which is lots and lots of small and medium enterprises producing new stuff, because I mean, in Germany, middle class people rent. Even now, they don't buy their houses.
What I always feel is that bricks and mortar outlive all of us. And these days, if you can't even get a lifetime mortgage, you're going to die before you ever pay that off. But what happens is that at the end of your life, it'll either have to be sold to pay for your end of life care, or the solicitors will have it all as the family feud about who's going to inherit whatever. And it's a right wing ideology that drives people into the idea that you're more safe and more secure owning your own bricks and mortar. It's not true, because if you even a private landlord, you'd have a few more rights. It would be more difficult to repossess your home than it would with a mortgage provider. So therefore, the whole idea that, you know, own your own home and you're going to be safer, it's well known in academic circles that that's actually not true.
Well, I would say most people who do own their own homes, they don't have to pay rent. They've got obviously all the other things to pay, electricity. But that's a real relief that you don't have to find that massive money every week or every month. And it's also more secure. You're more secure in your home. Maybe you won't be able to pass it on because inheritance taxes have been brought in.
Because if you lose your job, it only takes two pay packets. Your two pay packets.
Well, that's
away
for renters, not for homeowners. If they've paid the mortgage off, that's what they're responsible. Homeowners are aspiring to get to the point where they don't have to pay it anymore.
Back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, there was a place where you could actually buy your home. Do you remember homes were affordable? They're not affordable anymore. Mm. So the idea that, you know, you will be safer if you own your own bricks and mortar somehow, you somehow got to get a mortgage, get on the property ladder. I mean, one of the things about the new build ideas, good for the construction industry, of course, but there was a stat once that said that for every homeless unit in the country, and we're talking about from street homeless to sofa, surfing to kids who are staying on at home to whatever, there are 20 empty properties in this country, second homes and all the rest of it. So maybe a bit of refurbishment, because as you said earlier, people tend to leave things lying fallow, don't they?
Well,
to accumulate the asset wealth.
Well, look, this week we've had how would you describe what we've seen? Because Chancellor Rachel Reeves has been cutting benefits for disabled people, already rather hard done by, as we were hearing the last couple of weeks here in Bristol, putting bus gates in so people can't get, disabled people can't actually get out of their homes anymore. But they're being told, no, we're going to take away some of these disabled mobility benefits, things like this, in order to spend the money on defence.
It's absolutely disgraceful. I mean, the impact assessment has shown that this is going to hit, you know, so many people, pushing, is it 50,000 more children into poverty? You know, these are not moral decisions. These are fiscal decisions. And I think Reeves actually created her own fiscal rules that she intended to stick by, was it? So it's not for the good of people. And to actually target the most vulnerable in society, and there are many, many categories and complications with this. One of them that hit me was the idea that no young person up to the age of 22 can claim that element of the health care needs. And that will really, really hit the young people that are coming out of care. Now, you come out of care at 18 years old, you are most likely not to have any family that are going to help you and support you. So what do you do? I mean, I can see that people are just going to turn to crime because there won't be any safety net for them.
You know, a lot of them might just simply get jobs abroad. They'll be off.
Oh, that would be nice, wouldn't it, if you could?
Well, a lot of people do. I mean, they're finding jobs in Europe, anywhere else in the world, maybe Asia. This place is not much of a future here. I think this is something that's been described. We'll hear a clip, I hope, later from BBC Question Time last night. I do try and watch it. We call it Borrow Time at home. But there was actually quite a good discussion on there about wealth taxes and whether this was a good idea. And there was only one person on the panel, but the entire audience seemed to think that wealth taxes were a good idea. And sometimes, you know, you get a sparky question from the audience and things come alive, as they did last night, looking at that. But let's go to Westminster on Wednesday, because there was all sorts of protesters outside Westminster as Rachel Reeves was imposing her budget cuts on everybody. Let's have a little listen to that now.
It was meant to be a simple update on the economy, but the UK Finance Minister's spring statement turned into a series of major announcements, with a big cut to welfare and a big boost to defence.
Today I can confirm that I will provide an additional £2.2 billion for the Ministry of Defence in the next financial year, a further down payment on our plans to deliver 2.5% of GDP by 2027. This additional investment is not just about increasing our national security, but increasing our economic security too.
Weaker than expected growth and a bulging benefits bill, with 1 in 10 working age people claiming for sickness or disability, has left the Chancellor of the Exchequer with few options on how to balance the books.
Britain spends more on welfare than it does on defence. But since US President Donald Trump signalled that America will no longer prop up European security, the government has pledged to increase the defence budget. So how can he do that? Rachel Reeves has ruled out any further tax increases or even more borrowing. So the only room for manoeuvre she's got is cuts. And that is deeply unpopular. It will mean some health benefits will be cut in half, and disabled people will find it harder to qualify for financial help.
Hello, everyone. We're ready to begin.
Ellen is one of those who worries how the changes might affect her.
It's going to have a huge impact on my life. At the moment, PIP, personal independence payment, is a reasonable small amount of financial assistance that helps me cover all the additional costs of being a disabled person. It allows me to access the therapies that keep me well and healthy, and ultimately means that I can stay and work at the moment and work part-time.
Social security, my friend!
Rachel Reeves hopes, despite the protests, that her decisions will boost UK's sluggish economy. But with the looming threat of a trade war ignited by US President Donald Trump, Britain won't avoid the impact of global turmoil. Milena Veselinovic, Al Jazeera, Westminster.
Yeah, so sometimes thinks it's great to get an Al Jazeera view of what's going on here in Britain rather than a BBC view. So, Martin, what the key point here is, is this going to work? Does the Chancellor know what she's doing?
The simple answer to that is no. But let's not beat about the bush here. I can't see where she's going with this. The problem is that she put these fiscal rules in place, and at one stage she said the credit cards maxed out. Yanis Varoufakis, who used to be the finance minister in Greece, mocked that and said that's just absurd to say things like that. And she's educated enough to know that that's not how it works. But she said that because she's got this delusion that she's got to keep the City of London happy and the Americans happy, and that's what we're about.
Does she think she understands economics? Because
she
was put across at the Royal Bank of Scotland as an economist. Actually, she was managing the customer call centre.
Well, I think she's relatively intellectually competent compared to, say, somebody like Liz Truss, for example, who really is ignorant when it comes to these questions.
How about John McDonnell, somebody like that?
Well, he knows what he's talking about, and of course he's been very critical of everything that's happened here. From a political point of view, what is a Labour government doing, turning round? They've refused to increase the two-child limit on benefits. They've turned around and kicked the disabled in the teeth and all this stuff, and these are their natural
voters.
So
this is what the attack on Jeremy Corbyn was about to a large extent, isn't it? The idea that we've got this little team that's actually coming up with all sorts of ideas which might threaten the City of London. So let's get rid of Corbyn and his mates like John McDonnell and bring in Reeves, Starmer and a new crew who are actually
much
more friendly.
Well, that's right. It's exactly the same as New Labour previously, but it's a Mark II New Labour, and the economy, in fact, because of the global situation, because the Americans blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which has obviously completely trashed the European economy, they're thinking very small ways. And of course they've now decided that they're going to spend loads of money on defence. Let's not go into why or what a waste it is, but the point is that they are way out of their depth in the middle of what's going on, because this, you know, with what's going on with Trump in the US, it's quite likely to be a fairly big stock market crash, for example.
Right, okay, so it's already coming. Let's just talk about this reason. 2.2 billion she wants to spend on defence, an extra 2.2 billion a year. So what's happened is the Americans have said, if you Europeans want to have a fight with Russia or anybody else, you're going to have to do it on your own. We're off. And so that's why she and other European leaders have been saying, okay, we're going to have to increase our defence budget. It's pretty simple, isn't it?
No, it's not, because the Americans are saying you've got to spend more money on defence and you've got to buy the stuff from us. Yeah? And of course,
well,
and in other words, maybe we're not going to go to war with Russia, but we are going to go to war with Iran. But in any case, all of this is going to happen in the very near future, and nothing that Rachel Reeves spends on it is going to make the slightest bit of difference.
Is this just the arms lobby, do you think, pushing? And they don't really know what war they want, but they just want money to be spent on their stuff.
That's true. That's true both in Britain and in the US. But you will see that European arms stocks went up with all of this talk of rearmament. And of course, in Germany, Merz has just got the current Bundestag to vote 2/3 majority to get rid of the debt ceiling, which is absolutely fundamental to German thinking for many, many decades.
That's right.
So that they can spend money on it. But of course, he didn't do it when he comes to power, because they're going to have to negotiate a new coalition now. And the new coalition, because of the spread of forces in the new Bundestag, would never get to a 2/3 majority to do this. The AfD for Germany, Alternative for Germany, for example, are totally opposed
to this.
That's
a bit sneaky.
Well, it is sneaky, but it just shows how far down the drain we've got. And the leaders in the West now are way out of their depth in terms of dealing with either the geopolitics or the economics of the crisis. They're just not up to it, any of them.
What's your thoughts about the 2.2 billion defence spending?
Well, I mean, we're always at war because it's the arms people that are the ones that are benefiting from all of it, of course. So it's in their interests, of course. Bristol has quite a huge chunk of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have protesters that go to all the different places, the Elbeuf, for instance, that are actually, we are complicit in the sending of these awful war machines over to commit genocide, for instance, in Gaza. We are complicit. And so unless we face up to this, that where is it going? You know, I mean, Corbyn, when he was campaigning and leader of the Labour Party, one of his manifesto pledges was to increase spending on, he called it the peacekeeping forces, because it would be directed in a very different way. So, I mean, I think we do agree with things like that to help with the peacekeeping. But the war machine, to feed it, it's endlessly, endlessly greedy. It will never be satisfied. And it makes the wealthiest amongst us unbelievably rich.
I can't help but think of, I don't know if you've seen the footage, I'm sure most people have seen the footage of these two RAF ground engineers turning up at the Paddington Bear statue. First of all, they started kicking it, and then they removed it from its, it was a Paddington Bear sitting on a seat statue. I'm not even sure what town it's in. But I think it's near Lynham, or maybe it's in Chippenham, somewhere like that, somewhere near Chippenham. And They just destroyed this Paddington Bear statue. They took it back to their base, and then disposed of it because they've made such a mess of it. And you think, well, is that so surprising when we've got an RAF which is actually out aiding genocide with the Israelis, that we've got star people being recruited into the RAF that are thugs and vandals that are just, I mean, I've got no great love for Paddington. Oh, he's all right, you know. But to see them finding something which is bringing a lot of pleasure to kids and just kicking it, smashing it, dragging it and trying to take it back to their RAF base just seemed an amazing story this week. I'm looking at it thinking, is this really where the military's come to since the Second World War?
I didn't actually see that, but it doesn't surprise me.
Martin?
Well, yes, I mean, the RAF base in Akrotiri in Cyprus, which is where all this bombing campaign has been coordinated from, and loads of spy flights over Gaza passing intel to the Israelis to carry out their various attacks. Of course, the people of Cyprus don't want it there at all. There was a war against the British in the 1950s. General Grivas was in charge of Aoka B, and he killed quite a few British soldiers and air personnel in that period to get them out. And the deal was that we'll go, but we want to keep this bit of Cyprus so that we can carry on sticking our finger into the Middle East. Now, that's all paid for from our taxes. So when you say, well, I haven't got a dentist and there's potholes in the road and all the rest of it, it's not the immigrants coming into Britain that's stopping that. It's because we're spending loads of money in Cyprus. And of course, people in Cyprus don't want it there. And of course, there's quite a potential for Nasrallah or Hezbollah to start firing missiles at that base, or to sink one of our ships in the Red Sea. And if that happens, suddenly Rachel and Sakir are going to be in way above their depth, because what are we going to do then?
So it was actually Newbury in Berkshire where this rather nice little statue of Paddington Bear sitting on a bench was wrecked and ruined by a couple of RAF engineers, ground engineers, Daniel Heath and William Lawrence, both 22, drunk and based at somewhere called RAF Odium, which is an old Second World War base, which is now a helicopter support base. But Martin, it does say something about the armed forces that this is the sort of thing that the RAF personnel now think that they can do and get away with.
Let's get a bit of perspective on this. 22-year-old lads, when they are drunk, do all sorts of really stupid and destructive stuff. This is just another example of that sort of thing, and the armed forces just recruit from that pool.
Far, far more serious about the armed forces is that it's absolutely riddled with misogyny, of course. So I think that, you know, to try and tackle those kind of issues would have a staying force over the misogyny created stuff that goes with those young lads behaving so badly.
On this very point, I was drinking in Easton the other week, and a gaggle of young girls came into the pub, and they were so young, I was thinking, are they old enough to be in a pub? That's how young they looked. But anyway, one of them had a balloon, which sat on the balloon. It said, good luck. And it was a balloon, so she let go of it. It went up to the roof, and they were buying their drinks, and I was propping up the bar, and I said, well, why do you need good luck? And she said, well, I'm in the RAF reserve, and I'm going out to Cyprus. And I said, are you going to Akrotiri? She said, yes. I said, well, you do realise that Nasrallah and Hezbollah might fire rockets at you, don't
and
you?
And blow it to pieces.
And her friend put her arms out and said, don't say that.
So that's why she needed
but, I mean,
the good
what
luck.
Was interesting to me about this little insurrection, because why are they calling up people like her to go to Akrotiri? It's because they're planning a war with Iran, which is what the Israelis and the Americans have wanted
and
all
also,
along.
I suppose the idea is they say, oh, look at these poor young girls, they've been killed by those evil...
Well, no, I'm just saying they're recruiting people like her. She's a girl, not a boy.
And she probably doesn't realise the danger that she's in.
Well, I imagine the sort of things the RAF do, which are quite technical. You don't really need to have loads of muscles. You need to be able to know what you're doing.
Anyway, so the money's going on the military, and it's coming from... Let's have a listen to our wonderful Chancellor, an excerpt from her speech on Wednesday. I thought it's quite funny the way they do the Prime Minister's questions, and then they have the Chancellor's statement, so that no questions can be asked about it for another week to the Prime Minister. So he's kind of... managed to dodge that. So next week, maybe. Maybe they'll be on holiday next week. I don't know. But anyway, so let's have a listen to wonderful Rachel Reeves explaining, as Martin says, she's an intelligent lady, a good economist, and or maybe not such a good economist, but she knows what she's doing, apparently, explaining why the cuts are necessary.
Mr. Speaker, last week, my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, set out this government's plans to reform the welfare system. The Labour Party is the party of work. We believe that if you can work, you should work. But if you can't work, you should be properly supported. This government inherited a broken system. More than 1,000 people every day are qualifying for personal independence payments. 1 in 8 young people are not in employment, education, or training. If we do nothing, we are writing off an entire generation. That cannot be right, and we will not stand for it. It is a waste of their potential, and it is a waste of their futures, and we will change it. As my right honourable friend said in her statement last week, the final costings would be subject to the OBR's assessment. Today, the OBR have said that they estimate that the package will save £4.8 billion in the welfare budget, reflecting their judgments on behavioural effects and wider factors. This also reflects final adjustments to the overall package, consistent with the Secretary of State's statement last week and the government's Pathways to Work Green Paper. The Universal Credit Standard Allowance will increase from £92 per week in 25-26 to £106 a week by 29-30. while the universal credit health element will be cut for new claimants by around 50% and then frozen. On top of this, we are investing £1 billion to provide guaranteed personalised employment support to help people back into work. And £400 million to support the Department for Work and Pensions and our job centres to deliver these changes effectively and fairly, taking total savings after that to the package to £3.4 billion. While spending on disability and sickness benefits will continue to rise, these plans mean that welfare spending as a share of GDP will fall between 2026 and the end of the forecast period. Very different to what we inherited from the party opposite.
One of the most extraordinary things about Rachel Rees's spring statement that we've got there, Martin, is this whole idea that health isn't really so important. We're wasting money on health. These people that have got sort of health problems means they can't get into work. We're probably best thing is just to cut the money that we're giving to them to try and help sort their health out. So it's almost like it's a punitive measure against the people who are at most vulnerable.
Well, that's exactly how it's been perceived by the general public. Obviously, some of the general public probably do feel that, you know, there's too many people on benefits of one kind or another, so they're appealing to that segment of the population. You know, the leader writers in the Daily Telegraph and the Daily Mail, this is the sort of thing they want to hear. What I would suggest about this is they're not going to save the money they claim they're going to save. Many of these people are actually find it quite difficult to get work, and I'm thinking of people I know, because they're not actually employable, and employers don't want to employ them. Now, if you want to put those people into work, which might be in their best interest, yeah, for them to do a bit of work.
I mean, amongst the millions,
but it costs more money, not less, to do that.
Yeah, amongst the millions of unemployed,
you don't save money.
Amongst the millions of unemployed, surely. I mean, you know, if there were no unemployed, then yes, you know, the idea is let's incentivise and help disabled people to get jobs. But you know, the point is surely that it's able-bodied people who should be doing these jobs first, isn't it?
Well, that's right.
Isn't that the obvious thing?
Well, that's what in Cuba, where they have full employment, every manager has to have a certain number of people on their books who they don't really want, but they have to employ them. But that makes Cuba quite inefficient. It's a communist country, so that's what they do. In this country, what we do is people who can't work, because employers don't want to employ them, then we've got to find something else to do with them. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't perhaps be helping them to go to work for their own good, but that isn't going to save you any money. Yeah. And I confidently predict that they will not save the money that they're talking about. And when she talks about it's going to be, but welfare payments are going to be reduced as a proportion of GDP, if the economy goes down the drain, as I suspect it will, GDP will get smaller and the proportion of welfare payments will go up.
So doesn't know what we're doing. So before we hear from Mal, what's the thinking? Do you think there's a strategy here? What's actually behind
She's reacting to events. Because what they could have done and should have done to get elected is say, vote Labour and we will raise taxes on wealthy people, which is actually quite popular.
What's the motive for penalising disabled people?
Because in the marginal constituencies that, Morgan McSweeney thinks they've got to win, because he's a very powerful person. He's a very important, person, 30-something Morgan McSweeney. We've got to win these red wall seats that we won last time. Now, they only won them last time because Reform stood, yeah? Mm. They didn't. The Labour Party didn't win them last when Corbyn was in charge because Reform didn't stand. So in actual fact, Morgan McSweeney and Starmer didn't in fact pick up many former Tory voters. What happened is the Tory vote was just split for the first time ever, yeah? And that was a very lucky bounce for them. But it doesn't mean that they by going after disabled people as they are, that they're going to win over those voters. Because if you want to be nasty to disabled people, then I'm sure Nigel Farage can be much nastier than you can. So what are you playing?
McSweeney is the chief of staff at Downing Street at the moment. And I'm sort of reminded, of this, I think it was philosopher John Dewey said that politics is the shadow cast over society by big business. And it seems to me that you've got a whole bunch of wealthy people who are just using politics to try to manage increasing their wealth. And isn't that really what the Labour Party... The Labour Party was set up to fight against that, but it seems it's now part of that, Mel.
I know, they've lost all morality as far as I'm concerned, because they seem to be... I mean, I don't really understand the logic of targeting disabled people. The PIP payments, you know, the personal independent payments, are independent of whether you're working or not. I mean, there are a lot of disabled people who want to work and who can work so long as the conditions and reasonable adjustments are made. Yeah. But as you said as well, a lot of employers don't want to have to spend that money. And I don't see how any money can be saved at all by targeting. I mean, in this country today, we have so many people who know of a disabled person in a household, in a family, and the carers that look after them. One of the awful offshoots of these cuts means that because PIP-related triggers for carers, if they're removed from people, then that means the carers lose their allowances as well. So I can see people losing jobs, actually, without the right sort of support. What I really wanted to do, because as you brought it up, the idea that Labour is actually not the social... principle for people. I wanted to remind people about Article 25 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And this should be the guiding principle for, you know, the Labour government. It says everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing and medical care and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age or any other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. And just to remind people, and I think this is why it hits home so much, is that this could happen to any of us. We're an accident away from, you know, being disabled ourselves or unfortunate things befalling us, where we find beyond our circumstances control that we just need the help of the state to support us. And I think that we should all be responsible for doing that. And it seems like Rachel Reeves has completely abandoned the idea of the well-being of people and the safety nets for those people in favour of business and the fiscal rules that she said that she must stick by.
Has she been captured by investors, the city, has the party, Labour Party, been captured now, Martin?
Well, I think that's pretty clear. I mean, and, you know, at one stage, Starmer said, you know, I know the left wing of the party don't like what I'm saying, but the door is over there. So he's quite clear about what he wanted to do. And, of course, Morgan McSweeney is quite keen about this because he sees that he wants Labour to be seen to be socially conservative.
I mean, this might be simply that it's a good way of attracting money into the party.
Well, what it does is it keeps the... They have attracted quite a lot of money into the party. Don't forget, Tony, that a lot of millions of pounds of Labour Party funds were given to a specious group of apparatchiki from the party who claimed they'd been discriminated against for being Jewish. Remember that?
Yes, I do, yeah.
That's right. And, of course, the party was advised by the legal advisers that if it went to court, they would lose. Nevertheless, Keir Starmer, Morgan McSweeney decided to pay these people off. So millions of pounds of my subs that I've paid since 1975 end up in their pockets. And of course, subsequent to that, we now find that the senior ministers have been taking lots of money from various Zionist-oriented business people.
Are you still in the party, Martin?
I still am a member of the party.
I do know people that, I mean, I remember when Richard Bergen came to Bristol and he said that things will turn around. So just stick in there, be a thorn
in
the side.
We've lost
just a minute. Yeah,
be a thorn in the side and things will turn around so that, you know, the left will rise again. But I remember that, and I know that all the loss of money that came from it was hundreds of thousands of Labour Party members.
That's right.
Leaving the party, and big business filled in the gap, didn't it? It certainly
That's
stepped
right.
up. And if you have a look at Starmer's cabinet to see how many of them have enormous sums of money donated to their campaigns and all sorts of things. I mean, we only hear in the papers about the freebies, you know, the tickets to Taylor Swift concerts and whatever. But in actual fact, we're talking about huge sums of money from huge lobby groups.
That's right, and of course the promise that you will be looked after when you finished your career,
yeah.
And all of that.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, the Labour Party actually had more funds during the Corbyn era than it had for years.
Oh, it was
and therefore, you know, but they don't want that.
No, it was in the black.
Yeah, they don't want that.
I think he could have done a world tour, couldn't he, Jeremy Corbyn? I think loads of people around the world were looking at him and said, this is interesting.
Well, he's still there. He was
and then he had his legs chopped off.
But I think, isn't the news that there's going to be a new alliance party launched? There's some very senior people that are going to be part of that. Yanis, for instance. Hopefully, and all those people that have been alienated will surge forward, perhaps, and we'll get away from the two-party system.
Well, I think that's a perfect way to go into our little chat with Crispin Flintoff this week. Now, for the people that don't know, it used to be called Not the Andrew Marr Show. It's now called The Crispin Flintoff Show. He used to live in London. He's now in Oxfordshire. But Crispin does what I think is an excellent weekly programme, much better than our one, but he's very, you know, he gets all sorts of top people on there. And I managed to pin him down this week because he did a brilliant post, I thought, anyway, on Wednesday evening, all about casualisation. Well, it's this idea of security of employment, and also about joy in the workplace. Because as he is about to tell you, he started off his working life in the National Health Service and had an absolute ball working there. He loved it. And as he points out, these kinds of ways of working have slowly but surely been dismantled.
I'm Crispin Flintoff. I've just realised that on the left, or any opposition to what's going on by the with the government and the Conservatives or Labour parties who are governing us, is very weak at the moment. There's nothing there. There seems to be a failure of organisation, and it's easy to blame individuals, but I think there's just a longer term trend that's been going on with people not organising, but also people being isolated from each other and being demoralised and feeling that there's no hope and that there's no point in doing anything. I've felt that myself. I kind of didn't understand why it was happening to me, that I was feeling this way, and why everyone else is so divided. And then I remembered just how it was when I was a teenager working in a hospital in London, and the feeling of camaraderie was just extraordinary. I mean, you'd have porters and kitchen staff and refuge staff and the sterilising unit and the doctors and the nurses and the catering staff. The whole hospital was full of people who just said hello to each other and got on with each other. They all went to the social club at lunchtime. They all had job security. Many of them, when I was there, were retiring, having had 40 years there, and coming back. They used to come back to the workplace after they'd left and hang around, and everyone had talked to them during their tea break, or they'd just be there during the day when people were working, and they'd just be chatting to them. And it was a great place to be in a work. Place, it was a great place to be. I can't really express how exciting it was to be in a hospital. I mean, it doesn't sound the most glamorous place, but there was a real buzz of like I say, this sort of esprit de corps. People were working together. And at that time, there had been no PFI, no privatisation of hospitals at all. And so all of the departments were run by the hospital and by the NHS. There was hardly any agency staff. It was a wonderful place to be. And I was 18 at the time, and I never wanted to go to university. I'd been at this hospital. I just wanted to stay there all the time. I actually didn't want to go to university. I'd rather have worked delivering sharps containers and nappies to wards than be studying philosophy at Glasgow University. And I've never forgotten that atmosphere of that workplace. And it's not there. This doesn't exist anymore. I mean, I've worked in other jobs since then. I've worked in the supermarket. I've worked in offices where I've been a sub-editor. And I've had some kind of job security until about the mid-2000s. They started then to really give people the fear of their job going. Lots of kind of cost-cutting stuff. How much paper are we using? All these kind of things. But the fear of redundancy was hanging over people in all the workplaces I was at from the 2000s. And after that, I've seen 6 month contracts is the regular best you'll get. And I've not actually managed to even get more than that in any workplace when I was working. And the atmosphere is totally different because you're not in a team. You're fighting for yourself. You have to be the one who's the best in your particular department. It's you against the others. There's no sense of we're working together. And you find that there's no sort of social life there either. So you're kind of pushed into isolation against each other. Which to me is just not going to make people feel happy or it's not going to make people feel part of a team or part of a community at work. And I can't help thinking that this is a deliberate policy to get people to fight for themselves against each other at work. And not have this kind of teamwork that I described in the hospital. And everything is about competition. I mean, that's, I suppose, what capitalism is about. They always talk about competition is the best for us. But it's not really the best for human beings. It doesn't even bring the best service or the best prices. Or it's a total myth about competition. I think that this is a real reason why lots of people are demoralized. Lots of people don't know what to do and they don't feel secure. They've got no network of community or workplace. And at the same time as that's happened, I have to say that the rise of social media has given people a fake community identity that I think is probably more damaging than good. I don't think social media lets people connect. It actually pushes people against each other. I'm sure there's some people who'll say it's really good because they get to call people cheaply or something like that. But the benefits are not outweighing the costs. And it's creating a society where we are full of either, you know, lonely people or people who are showing off on social media about their opinions or what they've got. And there's very little building of community going on. And if we're on the left, or I mean, I'll just say on the left because it's a shorthand, but if we're on the left, we need to build communities. That's what we're all about. We're not about being selfish and self-centered. And the platforms we've got are all about being selfish and self-centered. So it's kind of impossible to break through that. So we have arguments on social media that just cripple our ability to take on the government, whether it's Labour or Tory. I think it's worth maybe even giving up social media and just not doing it. I mean, I know some people who do it and they seem really happy. The people who don't use social media seem much happier to me than the ones who do. And workplace stuff, I mean, what are the unions doing? What happened to the trade unions? How did we get from... And I mean, actually, specifically on the NHS, how did the trade unions allow all those departments that I described, from the kitchens, the porters, every single one of those departments, you know, they've all been privatized, they've all been outsourced, so that those people are no longer working in a team across departments. There's no hospital team. It's all different things working for themselves. The whole thing about that could only have been brought about by collaboration with trade unions. And I've heard from Dr. Bob Gill, the trade unions involved with the NHS are really failing to call out what's going on. And they're not putting up a fight. And even now you're seeing stuff like trade unions and other groups saying, let's not let them privatise the NHS. It's already been privatised. And they're saying, let's not let them take the NHS away. Why can't they just come clean and let's work on bringing it all back into public control? Because it's just slowly been hollowed out and sold off bit by bit to private companies who make a packet out of us being ill. God knows how much money those car parks and stuff make. Anyway, you know, the NHS is only one area, but I think it's an important illustration to me. I mean, where I worked in the late 80s, and it's totally different. If I go back to that hospital, they won't let me hang around in that department at all because they might be seen. It's just incredible how kind of scary the workplace is now.
Do you know, I totally identify with what Chrisman's saying, you know, the idea of working for a common purpose and the camaraderie and people working together, and what the isolating and the dividing of privatisation does, of course, and the target setting, is completely and absolutely divide people. And I see now the NHS as something that is largely privatised. I mean, things like prosthetics, the blood products, all of these things are all separated out into these terrible target setting and business level idea of management, which is absolutely destroying people's the feeling of goodwill. And in the workplace today, what Crispin was saying, it's true, people are despairing. Where is the hope? Because in actual fact, very few of us, I'm retired now, but we're in a very rewarding, which NHS always was, of course, and it still has that feeling, doesn't it, with nurses and doctors, but very few of us ever are able to do that, because the majority of the workforce, I'm afraid, they gallop on the spot to pay the bills to make rich people richer. So the whole structure of this neoliberalist model of consumer-driven capitalist nonsense has got to be broken somehow, and we're not doing it with the new Labour, the new Labour. We need to have proper socialism, the way we get together and speak together. One of the things that happened in Bristol recently was that the allotmenteers all got together, Bristol Allotmenteers Resistance, and I don't think the council realised that there were well over 6,000 of us, and we all started to speak as a common voice together, and my goodness, we made progress, and we actually were able to face up to the very unacceptable things that were being proposed for us, and we were able to turn the tide. And so I think one of the things that has to happen is exactly what Crispin says. We have to take back the NHS into away from privatisation, and we have to nationalise our facilities. We're talking about water and all of our energy supplies and our transport, and everything needs to come under in a cooperative model for all of us, and we need to be able to regain the trust that we elect our public officers to do that for us and not be just working for themselves to better themselves.
Well, I was lucky enough to be working in the BBC in a similar era, the early 90s, late 1980s, and I can tell you it was exactly
is as Crispin describes. There was no real competition. Yes, we had a bit of friendly rivalry with other radio stations, but everyone was in the canteen together. There was not even a hint that you were maybe sacked for something, unless you did something really stupid. What it did is it fostered a tremendous, as he uses the expression, esprit de corps. Everyone was pulling together, and you get this sort of false multiplication, Martin, where the actual effect of what you're doing is massively better than it would be just if it was a bunch of people doing this on their own.
Well, I think the neoliberal philosophy has been tested to destruction. And, of course, they were able to do all of this because of the collapse of the Soviet Union and so on. They really got going then, because they had already dominated the Western world with these kind of ideas. They imposed them in Russia, which was an absolute disaster. But now, of course, they're facing up to a country, Russia, which has a nationalised arms industry. Can you imagine? Nationalised. And it's actually, they spend a tenth of what the Americans spend. And their army's the best in the world, and the Americans are rubbish. The Chinese have retained public ownership of credit. So you want to set up a private bank in China, there's a huge load of hoops you have to run through. So Jack Ma, who was the richest man in China, their equivalent of Musk, he tried to set up a fintech company. In other words, it was supposedly a technological company, but it was basically going to be a bank. And the Chinese Communist Party regulator said, no, you can't do that. And he disappeared for several months from the media in China. And then he reappeared in the poorest village in China at a conference about poverty in China, where he apologised to everybody for trying to set up this bank. He said he'd never do it again, and he applied to join the Communist Party. Now, in other words, the Western powers are now up against peer competitors who don't believe in neoliberalism, and in actual fact, they're going to win World War III, and the West is going to lose.
And isn't it Michael Hudson talks about this as finance capitalism versus industrial capitalism?
That's right. That's right. It's all about the whole thing of just chasing money and pushing up rents and so on. It's very good for those who are making the money at the top out of this. They can become very, very wealthy. But in terms of productive efficiency, it doesn't work. And they're now up against people who don't believe in that. I mean, you know, Belousov, who's the Russian defence minister, is in fact an economist, and he's been put in charge because he can organise all of what they need to do and make it synergise with civilian production as well, so they can get all the spin-offs out of it. And that's because they've got an overall strategy and a plan and the esprit de corps, and that's what works. All of this, individualisation, is ultimately not very efficient, because everybody's not doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're too busy looking after number one and trying to stamp somebody else down and get ahead. It's not actually an efficient way to run anything, is it?
Definitely not. You know, the best and most highly productive models for working in any area, I'm not thinking about just a particular business or an industry or whatever, is to have your team working together for a common purpose that they truly believe in. This has always been the best model, isn't it? I mean, I remember in the business school at UWE, one of the wonderful lecturers there, she likened the best kind of management of a business or whatever you care to call it would be likening it to a jazz band, so that you have all these different areas of expertise on all these different instruments. Everyone's paid the same, but you have something coordinating it so that you nod towards the saxophonist or the trumpet player to do their bit because they're best at that bit. And this produced the most fantastic productivity.
I just think it'd be useful to run through some of the, because we were just talking about the health service there, which still supposedly is in national hands, and so it wouldn't be so difficult to do exactly what Crispin said, just get rid of all the private companies. But I did an article back when Margaret Thatcher died for RT called Margaret Thatcher and the Man in the Shadows, where I did a kind of timeline of all the things that were privatised. So I'd just like to run through some of the industries which used to be run in this
socialistic, nationalised fashion, which are no more. So, one is buses. So, the bus industry, the bus, I remember doing a documentary down at one of the bus garage, Plumstead bus garage in Woolwich in London, and there was a marvellous spirit in that place. Everyone was, they loved coming into work in the mornings. They knew no one was going to sack them unless they did something really stupid. Then is British Aerospace, who were building aircraft. That was privatised. You go right the way down to that's the Falklands War. Associated British Ports. All our ports were in national hands. Shipbuilding, that was in national hands. So all of the people working in these various industries, the miners, the National Coal Board, so the miners were, that was in the hands of the state. British Leyland, car makers, were always in the hands of the state. I could go on and on. In fact, it's British Gas, another one. You know, all these things where people were working together for the public good in public service, Martin, they've all gone.
They have, and so some of them have just been privatised, and some of them don't exist anymore at all. A bit like the steel industry or shipbuilding, you know, just disappeared. We don't do it anymore. You can't recreate the past, especially after all the damage that's been done, and it is damage. You know, we shouldn't have done a lot of this stuff. It's undoubtedly stupid, but you can't just rewind the video and do it again. We need to have the same principles of social solidarity and industrial policy, but obviously it's going to be a bit different in the modern era than it would have been back then.
This week ain't nothing like that, I'm afraid. I've got a copy of the I Paper, which is my favourite daily newspaper, and as I say, just because they do such an excellent job in thinking compiling as much news as they can. Some of it is very short form. It's also got some good columnists in here from time to time. So the headline is tax hikes and extra cuts on the way as 250,000 people are pushed into poverty. Thank you very much, Labour. We didn't think that that was what actually the Labour Party was really all about, pushing 250,000 people into poverty as one of their policies. I don't seem to remember anyone who voted for Labour voted for that. So Rachel Reeves struggles to find any growth, with the forecast for 2025 has been halved right down to 1%. Now, I mean, this is the whole point of all of this, Martin, is she's desperate to get some growth. She seems to be getting nowhere.
I think economic growth is a bit of a red herring here, because how can we have endless growth in a finite world of resources? Because we haven't actually mentioned the destruction of the planet, which is, you know, something that we've got to turn things around, didn't we? Under the old Corbyn manifesto, the two things that could have been taken back into control was, one was a national bank service, which you referred to at one point, which was incredible for people, and the other was a like the NHS, but it would have been a general education service, because now all of our education is splintered into academies, and you know the scrabble for it. When I think about the academies selling off their playing fields at the moment and the land development that's going on, absolutely disgraceful. This privatisation divides everything that we need to feel is important to our lives, which is support and, you know, social services, basically.
So she's refused, Rachel has. Not quite sure what favours she did when she was at the Bank of England to get where she is today, but I've had a few hints from my London colleagues what they might have been. Chancellor refuses to rule out tax rises. Oh dear, but she said she wasn't going to raise tax. But is told by experts there is only 50-50 chance that she will have to hike them at the next budget, Martin.
Well, she's carrying... I mean, I take the point about growth in a general sense, you know, there's a limit to it and all the rest of it. But even if you had a limit to growth, you'd still want... you'd still want change, you understand? You want to improve what you're doing, yeah? You want to bring new technology and you want to do it more efficiently. So in those terms, having clarified that, she's basically Osborne Mark II, and she's going to find out, as Osborne did. Osborne brought in austerity to try and reduce the deficit, yeah, to balance the books. But what he did, and of course what he wanted to do was shrink the state, so that, you know, he did exactly the same sort of thing she's doing, but even worse. And of course what happened is the economy actually starts to go down. The Japanese government has been trying to get growth into the Japanese economy for the last 30 years, and you don't do it. Every time you try to reduce government expenditure, it starts to go down.
So where,
and then your tax relief, the tax take goes down, and your benefit bill goes up, so the net result result of all of the austerity of Osborne was to increase the deficit. And this is what will happen with Rachel. Because as the economy goes down, because you shouldn't, you can't increase taxes on poorer people. The only place to get the money is from wealthy people.
So
that's the only place.
Growth, I take your point, Mal. Growth is, surely there are different places in the economy where growth can take place. So, for example, growth might take place because people have got more money in their pocket to spend, or growth might take place because the asset prices of big buildings in London are growing. Now, some of that benefits society, others works against it, and it seems to me most of the growth that she's going for is actually not going to do anything for ordinary people. So it looks good on the balance sheet or whatever, but it's actually detrimental to society as a whole.
Instead of cuts, it should be investment in public services. That's right. Because if you give people more money in their pockets, then they will spend more. So that affects every single part of our society. And it's just so self-defeating, the idea that you put the pinch on people who have the least anyway.
Well, and it's also self-defeating. Yeah, these are the people who will spend the money if you give it to them.
Isn't the idea,
whereas
here,
if you give the money to people, wealthy people, they're just going to stick it in the Cayman Islands or go and have a ski
holiday?
Isn't
the idea to discredit elected politics and leave our management of our country to unelected investors, bureaucrats, finance people, technocrats, fascists?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what Elon Musk sees himself as being in the US. You know, we're going to get rid of the Department of Education and I'm going to take it over. Yeah? And
Department for Government Efficiency.
It's Department
Doge.
You elected people, you're very inefficient. Goodbye.
Well, that's right. I mean, what it is in terms of the Labour Party here, it's they are... What's the word I'm looking for?
Well, while you're thinking of your word, can I give a couple of figures?
Yes, go on.
800,000 people are going to lose their disability benefits. That's over 750,000. That means that even though they're disabled, their benefits will be going. So that means they won't be able to get around. And it's also like a punch in the face from Rachel Reeves. Around about 250,000 people, including 500,000 children, are going to be pushed into poverty by this woman's measures. The Labour Party is also quite angry at Rachel Reeves. She says that the cuts to the ballooning benefits bill and job cuts to meet her fiscal rules, there's quite a lot of Labour people, even some Labour MPs, are getting a little bit annoyed with her.
Well, you can see there's going
these
to
figures
be,
are incredible. There's going to be really pushback. Best part of 1 million people to disability benefits taken away, and 250,000 pushed into poverty, including 50,000 children. What the hell is she doing?
Well, the attitude is that these people are generally going to be, if they're going to vote at all, they're going to be Labour voters in safe constituencies.
Is she just looking for a good job when she gets out of politics in the city of some sort?
Well, she probably is thinking in terms of a long-term career in, you know, I'll go and be a head,
maybe
head
she'll
on
be
a
European commissioner or someone at the IMF. Who
I think
knows?
it's more to do with poverty of imagination. Yeah, they really, you know, it's safety first. I mean, when she came out and said that we've outmaxed the credit card, that is absolutely wrong.
But is she actually making these decisions, or is someone just sticking a piece of paper in front of her and saying, now read this, Rachel?
No, she's making the decisions, but she's doing it within the context where she's being, you know, she's talking to the people who, you know, have you seen the way they've been sucking up to big business? You know, they've been inviting them in. They've been going to visit them.
Oh, we had BlackRock, didn't we?
That's right. Well, they're saying to Larry, is it Larry Fink?
Fink, yeah.
They're saying, Larry, come and invest. And their whole idea for investment in this country is to get outside foreigners to come and invest.
Well, we were hearing...
Which they're not going to do unless they get what they want.
We were hearing from...
Rather than investing, if you want something, Rachel, raise the taxes and do it yourself.
Well, we were hearing from Joe last week, Joe Banks, the local freelance journalist, that the most capital flows in the world are now coming to Britain to invest all over the country, every city, in these purpose-built student accommodations, because they're delivering the fastest, most reliable returns on planet Earth right now.
Huge for international students, because there's no cap, of course, on international students. And so what's happening in Bristol at the moment, what's it going to be, the tallest purpose-built student accommodation building in I think the Leeds one is going to be the tallest in the world, isn't it? But these kind of developments It went through the planning departments, and then they went back to try and adjust it to let it's
that's right. They get their planning permission. Yeah. They get their planning permission, and they go back and say, actually, can we have another 10 stories?
Yes, they do that, but they also reduce the living accommodation, get rid of the balconies, more beds, less shared accommodation. They're sort of like glorified bedsits, aren't they? But with communal living space. And this is not just, it's supposed to be for young professionals as well as students. But this kind of housing model is not going to help people who need homes. This is absolutely disgraceful. But the financial backing behind it is pouring in, as you said. And so the council is kind of like, they did defer on that latest decision about, you know, adapting the accommodation to be even less accommodating. But in actual fact, our councillors now, because we're now green-led, aren't we? But they're completely dependent on the council officers to advise them, just like the civil service, on how to make the best decisions.
They've also got central government saying, oh, we're taking the brakes off planning, so don't even think about going against any of this.
Yeah.
I suppose Rachel's cock-a-hoop about all this investment coming into Bristol, even if it is coming from an Israeli company, which is building some little training place for the Israeli Defence Force so they can train for killing people in Gaza.
Let's talk about that. I mean, we're supposed to be in Bristol not enabling any sort of backing of Zionist genocide, you know, that's happening at the moment. And yet these people with this money, I mean, I think we have details of that, don't we, exactly who is providing the money?
Joe looks into it.
Yeah, we were talking about it last week. Menorah Mitchavan is this Israeli investment firm that's not only building the purpose-built student accommodation here, the biggest tower block we've ever seen in the city, of little pigeonhole boxes to live in, but they're also building this, they've also built this place for the Israeli army to train in the Negev Desert, train for Gaza.
Yeah, they don't make any secret of it at all. And these pigeonholes, I mean, there was a figure put on it. Students are going to be expected to pay between £300 and £400 a week for this kind of
They don't pay a lot of the time. I don't know if you saw it, but there was a fascinating thing in the Sunday Times last Sunday all about the scams around these student loans. So even foreign students are able to get these student loans. And as the Sunday Times found out, I'm no big fan of Murdoch and his empire, but it's a fascinating report. That what they're able to do is to, say, apply for a course, get on the course, get the first £4,000 or so tranche of their student loan to go to the university, and then they don't even turn up. They just take the £4,000 and run. And that's actually, I wouldn't suggest listeners do that, but apparently it's really easy to do, and you just get £4,000, and then that's sorted you out for the next few years. But that's the scandal, is that's the reason the government has made this so easy to get these loans, is because they see this as a great way of getting investment into Britain. But what is it actually doing for the city to have all these, and any other city in Britain, to have all these purpose-built student accommodation? I question that.
Well, the student population of Bristol has doubled in the last decade, isn't it?
I'm sure we could have at least another double the students. We could fit them in somewhere. Maybe they'll start tunnelling and put little boxes under the ground for them to live in, just about as big enough for like something from a morgue. You know, you slide the person in for the night, and then they wake up in the morning and they slide themselves out.
But getting back to you know, the housing crisis. I'm just thinking about in my street, two young men from London came down. People from London, they think, oh gosh, it's quite cheap in Bristol, isn't it? Quite marvellous, edgy and wonderful and quite cheap. They moved into a very tiny little place together to share, and they're paying £1,600 a month rent. Now, this is not unusual. People can't afford it. It's absolutely disgraceful.
Well, if you deal drugs as well, then it makes it a little bit easier to afford.
A bit easier.
If you get involved in any other sorts of organised crime, it suddenly becomes a little bit easier to afford these things. Anyway, the point of this is it doesn't benefit people. This benefits the super rich, and it benefits foreign investors, Rachel. And that's the people that you seem to be serving, not us. But there was, as I said earlier, there was quite an interesting little intervention on BBC Question Time last night about this by a guy called Gary Stevenson. I don't really know much about him, Martin. I think you mentioned him in the past, have you?
I don't know.
He's an investor of some sort.
I've been listening a lot to him. He's right. Talking a lot of sense.
Well, he was on there last night.
Yeah, I haven't watched it yet, but I keep seeing him all over the place. And his ideas of on the economy are absolutely fantastic. And he actually is a millionaire himself, and he sees all the terrible pitfalls of, because he remembers where he came from, of how to reorganize things, because his chief thing is about inequality and how this is destroying society.
Well, this is one of the things I love about owner-occupier farmers, and anyone with plenty of wealth, is they say exactly what they think. They've not got to trim what they're saying to what they're expected to say, so they don't lose their job. Anyway, so here's Gary Stevenson, amongst various other guests, and of course the lady from Antiques Roadshow, who oversees the whole fiasco, on BBC Question Time last night.
The original question was, who is going to be plugging the deficit? Is it going to be benefits claimants or billionaires? The answer to that question is it's going to be employees and their employers, because the tax burden has risen to a record high. It's projected by the end of Parliament to be 37.5%. And what's difficult for the electorate about that is that even though the tax burden is at a record high, and indeed government spending is at a record high, it's expected to be 45% of GDP by the end of the Parliament, actually people feel that they're not getting adequate services from the state, and indeed state productivity remains below pandemic levels. I can see Gary's argument, because regardless of us all paying more tax, and let's be honest, you're quite right to say that working people particularly are taxed way too much. In an area like Dartford, you have to question the sense of, on one hand, taxpayers' cash being used to build something like the Dartford Crossing, and then on the other, being charged the Dart charge to use it. It feels like we're not just taxed once, but multiple times if you factor in income tax, VAT, council tax, fuel duty, car tax and all the rest of it. So that's a problem. Having said that, when we do look at episodes in history where the rich have been taxed more, for instance, you mentioned 1950s Britain. Let's look at 1950s America. Back in 1950s America, the top rate of tax was a staggering 91%. However, unemployment shot up to 8%, and there were four recessions in that period. So I think the man here raised a point about capital flight. We need to make a decision as to whether we want millionaires' cash to go into the exchequer or not. I appreciate that millionaires and billionaires do have a habit, seemingly, of avoiding quite a lot of tax. But let's use the example of Sir Jim Ratcliffe, okay, the owner of Ineos. Before he moved to Monaco in 2020, he was adding hundreds of millions to HMRC. Now he's contributing nothing, because he's a classic example of, if the tax take gets too high, then unfortunately contributions go down because the rich can afford to move elsewhere and avoid it. Not progress.
Can I ask you a quick question on that?
Mm.
Do you think that China would allow somebody to own billions and billions and billions of pounds of Chinese assets and then move to Monaco and not pay tax on those assets?
I have no idea what the policy would be in China, but then lots of billionaires in China are reliant on slave labour, so it's probably not the best example.
Listen, we have given the literal assets of this country to very, very, very wealthy people, and we have created a tax system that makes it voluntary for them to pay tax. If you do that, ordinary people will get poorer and poorer and poorer every year, and millionaires and billionaires will get richer and richer every year, and ordinary people will not be able to buy homes and have families.
But Gary,
and
I'm not just saying that, I bet on rich that. Don't pay year. Tax in the UK, are you?
The tax burden is falling on working people. Working people pay rates on higher levels.
But you also agree, I appreciate that working people are paying tax. Everyone's paying tax. Is anyone who's working not paying tax? The rich do pay their taxes. You're saying that you think they should pay more tax on their wealth? And are you differentiating between wealth or inheritance?
Wealth. They should pay tax on their wealth. If you don't tax these people on their wealth, they will squeeze everybody out.
And the European examples where that's been tried, France, Norway, etc., where they've had to scrap those schemes because A, they're too much to administrate, and B, they don't get enough revenue in. What's your response to that? Because it's not as if European nations haven't tried this. They've tried it, and unfortunately, it's failed.
Yeah, whenever people suggest this to me, I always think of the Conservative second home stamp duty tax. Do you remember that?
Yeah, but do you want to answer that question?
Yeah, I'm answering it now.
Okay.
Yeah,
What do you think we would do differently when the European countries have not done?
When the second home stamp duty tax was brought in, I was very surprised because I didn't think the Conservatives would tax rich people. I looked into it. There was an exemption for people who bought seven or more homes at once. And then Jeremy Hunt went and bought 7 homes. Listen, I understand it is difficult to tax rich people because politicians are rich people and they're funded by rich people and they put loopholes in the system that mean rich people don't pay them and it ends up being paid by working people. That doesn't mean we don't do it.
Okay, if you
don't
I'm not do sure that's answered the question. And I've no idea if Jeremy Hunt did buy 7 homes in Stanley, but, you know, I appreciate that's what he said.
Is there a guarantee that the wealth tax receipts go to the poor? This is the other problem.
Let me bring Daisy.
They could
bring
go
Daisy
to public sector pay rises for train drivers that are already on good
Camilla,
wages.
Let's let Daisy answer the question because she's sat there for quite some time now. Who should be plugging the deficit, benefit claimants or billionaires?
We Liberal Democrats have repeatedly said that we should be raising revenue in a fairer way. And the way to do that is to go after the companies that are making billions and billions and billions in profits that can afford to pay a little bit more to help get our public services back on their feet. So we would start by reversing the tax cut that the Conservatives gave to the big banks, take it back to 2015 levels. We would increase taxes on the big social media companies, on the big online gaming companies that are making billions of pounds in profits. And that would be an alternative way to raise the money that we desperately need to get our NHS and our education system back on their feet. But at the same time, the gentleman alluded to this earlier, we have got to get growth into our economy. The fastest, simplest way to get more growth into our economy right now is for the UK government to actually renegotiate our trading deal with the EU so that British businesses can trade more easily. We Liberal Democrats did some research and found that since Brexit, British businesses have had to complete 2 billion pieces of paper just to trade with Europe. That amount of paper could wrap around the world 15 times. We should be renegotiating that trade deal, getting rid of that red tape, unleashing the potential of British businesses that want to trade more freely with our European neighbours and get a customs union that works with British businesses by 2030.
And just briefly, because a number of Labour MPs have called for this, Gary's obviously calling for it, do the Lib Dems support the idea of a wealth tax?
No, I think the problem with the wealth tax is generally it doesn't work. It's been tried in a lot of different countries, and over the course of the last sort of 20 years, I think those 12 countries have reduced down to just 3 countries, and the 3 countries that are using it have a completely different tax system. So there are problems with wealth taxes. They're very difficult to administer. It's very hard to assess the cost of how much some things are in terms of intellectual property and artwork. They're very complicated. They're administratively difficult,
so
and they
don't
work.
It's not a Lib Dem policy.
But it's not a Lib Dem policy, but we can go after those big businesses that are making billions of pounds.
So there is quite a long clip from the Question Time last night with Gary sticking his oar in the middle. The woman at the start who was making a very, what she felt was a very good case for there's absolutely no point in having a wealth tax, was Camilla Tominey, who writes for the Daily Telegraph. Now, Martin, what about the arguments that they were making there, saying basically it's impossible to bring a wealth tax because the people will just move their wealth out of the way as soon as you try and tax it?
Well, I think that during the Second World War, the top rate of income tax in this country was 95%.
Well, no, we're talking about assets.
No,
here.
I know.
Wealth,
I'm just
so money in the bank, or else, I suppose,
I'm just saying that if we go to war with Russia, as we're told we're going to be doing, then I'm afraid wealth taxes will be part of that. And Daily Telegraph columnists had better get used to the idea. Because if you want to get rid of Mr. Putin, we're going to have to go to war, and there's going to be rationing and all sorts of things.
How do you get the money off them? She says you can't.
All right, well, I'll tell you how you get the money off them. If you are a British citizen, you see, what was his name? He used to be the chair of the Conservative Party. He said he lived in Belize. He was the chair of the Conservative Party. From the name will come to me in a minute. You can probably look it up on the internet. And he said he lived in Belize and therefore he didn't have to pay taxes in Britain. Now, in practice, he didn't really live in Belize. He used to pop out there once in a while because he had some business interests
out
there.
You have to spend a few days a year there, don't you, to say you live there.
But, I mean, the simple answer to that is to just say, if you want to keep your British citizenship, including the right of residence in Britain...
Michael Ashcroft.
That's right. That's the one. If you want to keep your... It's quite simple. In World War II, this is what we would have done. Yeah? You say, right, if you want to keep your British citizenship, including right of residence in Britain, you must pay taxes on all your wealth in all of the world, not just in Britain. I say, well, I made some of my money in Belize. Doesn't matter. You've still got to pay tax on it in Britain.
Now,
if you want to keep... You have to pay tax in Belize as well. So the wealthy have got to pay tax where they live. If they live in Monaco, they have to pay tax in Monaco. And if you're a British citizen, you also have to pay tax in Britain. And, of course, back in the 1960s, people were trying to run away from taxes in France. Yeah. And, they were all going to Monaco to get away from paying taxes. Guess what General de Gaulle did? he just put a military guard on Monaco and wouldn't let him out and wouldn't let him in. And of course, that's how serious you are you about going to war with Putin and getting rid of him?
Well,
that's going to mean it's not going to mean you're going to die, darling. Nobody's going to blow your head off, but I'm afraid you're going to lose your second home, and you're not going to have the foreign holidays anymore.
He's known as Lord Ashcroft of Belize.
Lord Ashcroft.
That's the way they're taking the Mickey out of him in the House of Lords now.
Yeah. Well, hang on, this is the point, isn't it? And that's easy to solve. And you can say, well, that'd be against their human rights. Someone, no. If you want to be a British citizen, you've got to pay all your taxes wherever you live. Otherwise, you can't come back here.
There's a very funny thing that people don't quite understand, the difference between tax evasion and tax avoidance. And the thing is that if we get back to the idea that, which is an ideologically driven thing, that these scrounging disabled people that are all claiming this, that and the other thing, the disability fraud figure is absolutely minute. If you look at a pie chart, it's something like 0.3%, and that includes the error, DWP's own error. And if you look at the tax evasion and avoidance figures, that we're talking billions. We're not talking about people having to pay more tax than they should. We're just talking about people paying, you know, it wouldn't even make any difference to them, paying what they ought to pay because they need to be able to be the broadest shoulders.
You've made such an important point there that these people wouldn't even notice if they lost half their wealth.
No.
We would.
I think Mr. Musk at the moment, how many millions has he lost with his Tesla at the moment?
Billions. Well, I think, with Tesla, we covered this last July. Musk took about 50 billion out of Tesla. So he's looking at the world markets, realising, those electric vehicles are not selling so well. So he just took 50 billion out of the company and it's now just struggling to survive. But he's cut and run.
But I wanted to just point out the difference between a millionaire and a billionaire as well, because if you were to count to a million, 1, 2, 3, and you carried on, and you didn't actually lengthen it because you said 643, 600, what I mean? It would take you about a month to count to a million. Now, if you were going to count to a billion, it would take you over 30 years. That's the huge difference. Our brains can hardly grasp the fact. But the fact is that these billionaires that are now even richer than they ever were before, just with an nth of what they have, which is earned in interest in 3 minutes or whatever it is, we could solve so many of the world's problems.
Yeah, David Cameron's father was actually the pioneer of moving your wealth offshore to avoid tax. Maybe that's why his son became Prime Minister. But anyway, let's have a listen now, I think, to... I interviewed him about something completely different, which we'll hear after the break. But Stephen Dorrell is a writer, a sort of lefty writer. He's written the unofficial history of MI6. He's also written about Harold Wilson. He's done a biography of Oswald Mosley. Two great books on the Profumo affair, which are both steamy and politically fascinating, so that's the sort of thing I like to see. But he has had quite a lot to say to me about why he thinks we're now in the situation where the British economy is in such a mess. Martin, before we hear from Stephen, can you just give me your take on... Post-war, Britain was chugging along. We had industries, we had steel, we had all sorts of things like coal, which apparently is no longer in favour, that sort of thing. There is a point that Stephen says he thinks that the British economy started to then take a dive. So what can you give us your take on that?
It's pretty obvious, really. It's the late 70s. We had a Labour government and they started to lose the plot in terms of keeping... You know, for example, when we discovered North Sea oil, we could have actually had a nationalised oil industry as the people in Norway did, but the Labour government decided to get the American multinationals in there quickly so that they could get the money quickly, so they could use the money to try and bribe the electorate to win the coming election, which didn't work, but it meant that and then of course Thatcher came in and she really, you know, most of the problems we're facing now are Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher privatised things she shouldn't have privatised. She deregulated the City of London, which led directly to the 2008 crash. And the third thing which people forget is she created Al-Qaeda, which is, that was created by MI6 and your taxes, folks. And that wasn't a brilliant idea, was it? And that's those are the three things she did. And those are the three things causing us the most trouble now.
Well, let's have a listen to Stephen. And here's Stephen Dorrell and his analysis of whereabouts the British economy started to hit the buffers, started to go through the floor.
The Mirror is an interesting newspaper because it does start off, you know, 1945 is very pro-Labour. But when you get to the 60s, it's a different regime. And there are some odd things about it. I mean, the Cudlips themselves had intelligence connections. And I got a document about CIA connections to his brother, who was another journalist. And Cudlip had moved to the right, not in terms of the Labour Party. So he wasn't that pro-Wilson by that stage. Interestingly, of course, they set up, because this was Odom's Press, they set up The Sun in, was it 64, as a pro-working class, aspiring working class newspaper. And actually, for about 5 years, it was very good. We had it, and you know, we were a very working class family. And it had a readership of about 1 million, but it wasn't making enough money for the Mirror Group, and so they ditched it. And the Mail at that stage wasn't the newspaper quite as we know it today, because actually we were talking about investigative journalism. One of the best investigative journalist units was on the Mail, which in the mid-60s had set one up, and as you said, had a barrister and all the rest of it, and doing things. So there were changes going on in the media empire and the newspapers, and they were starting to change their political allegiances. So Cudlip did a version of this. There is a version from Zuckerman, and there is a slim version from Cecil King, which basically comes down to whether Mountbatten was serious or not. It seems that Mountbatten was intrigued by the idea, and Zuckerman kind of pulled him out of it. And it got to the stage where they supposedly talked about, well, this might bring out machine guns on street corners in London and all that kind of thing. Now, the background of this was there were things going on in the military. There were people talking about maybe we have to intervene and do something. Now, and the report did go to MI5, which we've never seen, and we don't know what's in it. But they did do some investigations into this. Now, further back, the context of this is the Vietnam War and the anti-Vietnam demonstrations. The Grosvenor Square one, which was massive. And in the lead up to that, there were a number of strange things happened. There's now the inquiry into the SDS, the police squad infiltrating people into left-wing groups, which starts in 1968.
That's the special demonstration squad.
Yes. And, I mean, we didn't know about this, but I did write a piece 20 years ago saying, look, there's some odd things going on here. It's clear that some of the left-wing groups were infiltrated. There were burglaries, there were fake posters for demonstrations, leaflets were put out. There was a guy called Vic Norris who appeared pretending to be on the left and brought out demonstrators, but he wasn't. He was on the right. There is an account by an MI5 officer called Ronnie Reed who says, actually, we infiltrated the main demonstration and one of the parts where there is a bit of violence going on was led by one of our men from MI5. And that was a Maoist group. When you see Maoist groups, you always worry because these tend to be the groups that are put in as false flag kind of things. And so there was a lot going on, and there's still things we don't know. We know that there were some stories planted, like in the Evening Standard through Special Branch, warning about violence, that there was going to be some people in the demonstration who were determined to make it violent. And Callahan did an investigation into this because he got worried and discovered, in fact, it was a false report and somebody had planted it with the newspaper. And there were, so there were these things going on, and this was going in the background of King. And King was a person who said he had grandiose ideas of himself, but he kind of had fears about the decline of society, about permissiveness, about, as you mentioned, the losing of empire, the falling economic standing of Great Britain, which was losing out, particularly to Germany and the burgeoning European community. And so he was determined to do so. And there were some politicians within the Labour Party who wanted Wilson out. And there were some Tories who were willing to kind of join in a kind of national government. Now, at one stage, King actually had meetings with Oswald Mosley. He thought that Mosley might be somebody who could return and lead a new national government. So it was a very interesting time, socially, politically, world politics. And Wilson was trying to keep all this together with an economy which was starting to turn bad, that we really didn't export enough, imports are going up, and the balance of payments. I mean, nobody really talks about the balance of payments anymore, but on the news, it was always the balance of payments, and it didn't look good. And so Jenkins, who became the Chancellor...
Sorry, just to explain to people that what that is, the idea is the, you know, the wealth flowing into the country and out of the
imports
country...
Imports and exports.
Totted up every month to see... And of course, it was all going south, you know, because we were deindustrializing. People were making sensible, I suppose, the only policy decision you could make, which is to start to import much more.
Well, yeah. I mean, the real problem was lack of investment. We just did not invest. I mean, I came from Kidderminster, which was a carpet town. And the equipment there had been put in the beginning of the 19th century, and they hadn't changed it. You know, and then you start to get new carpets coming in from China and other places, which are much cheaper. And so you start to lose out, and that happens across the board, you know, shipping, all the rest of it. Just a lack of investment. But what happened was that the right, the free marketeers who are starting to appear in the Tory party, are blaming the unions. They're blaming the trade unions. And that is what really takes off in the 70s, is the attack on trade unions, which they see as funding the Labour Party. They see people like Jack Jones, Scanlon, Gunter and others being very close to the Labour Party, and it breaks the consensus that there had been throughout the 50s, early 60s, with the Tories, Labour, that you cooperate with trade unions, you sit down, you have sandwiches, and, you know, beer and talking out, and now that's broken. And even Wilson is pushed that way by the seaman strike. He receives reports from MI5 about Communist Party infiltration and all the rest, that they're directing it. And some of that is true, but the real point is the trade unions become the thing that is blamed. The MI5 and groups like, private groups like Common Cause, IRIS, Economic League are fed intelligence information, which they use in the media to attack trade unions. And so when you get to post-68, things are not going so well for the government. Jenkins is the exchequer, and he has to bring in some cuts, which do actually work, and the economy is starting to turn in end of 70, 69, and then they lose the 70 election. And some people think it's because of a particularly bad week on the balance of payments, when we buy in a load of aircraft from the Americans, and it makes the trade balance look really bad. So Wilson manages to keep the party together. He stays as leader, and Heath comes in. And really, things go to pot with the 73 oil crisis. That really changes everything. And there are some economists, and I go along with it, that we've never really recovered. That the 73 oil crisis is the end of what became known as the golden age of the British economy, and in Germany, France, and whatever. And what happened was that British industry, the city, decided not to invest. They could see the way things were going, and they decided to take their money, basically.
So that's Stephen Dorrell. A longer version of that, the full version, will be up on our show page later tonight, thisweek.org.uk, taking us through the Wilson plot, the 73. This was the oil crisis there. He's saying that he thinks was the turning point in the British economy post-war. That's the Yom Kippur War, isn't it? This was the Arab countries, OPEC, saying, well, if you're going to support the Israelis, we're going to jack the oil price up, everybody. And we had big queues outside, and I talked to Stephen about that, because he was saying he was a petrol pump attendant in 1973 watching all these people queuing up for oil. But anyway, Mel, what do you make of this, is there any way, do you think, to sort of turn this around, leaving us with a bit of a high note? Because it would be, you know, it is a bit depressing, as Crispin is saying. We're going to be hearing from him finally, actually, what he thinks. But let's hear from you first.
Well,
is there any light at the end of the tunnel for
me? I think there is light at the end of the tunnel, because I do have my hopes in the younger people becoming more and more aware. And despite all the fake news and misinformation of the internet, what they can't do is stop us talking to each other. And I'm finding that the real time of young people becoming more aware, and it's you know, the multiple voices of people, because you can't govern unless by consent. And if you have enough people who are turning around and saying, well, actually, it's our duty to resist this because, you know, the law is wrong in this. So I don't think I'm too old now, but my bit of activism that I've been doing in Bristol, and I just want to give a plug for it, is the numbers of us as allotmenteers have managed to actually hold our own. And we're now, our next Bristol Allotment Forum meeting is on the 23rd of April. So anyone out there who has an allotment, please do email bristolallotmentforum@gmail.com. Look for us on social media, we're on Instagram as well, and come and join us and be a voice with us. Because also, it's about protecting our land for future generations.
Now, the thing is, with an allotment, not everyone is going to be really inspired by that. People don't have the time to grow food. And also, of course, we're all a bit amateurs. We might be trying to grow something, and we end up at the end of the year with a whole load of shriveled green mush we can't actually eat, can't we?
It's actually, allotment law is very different. I mean, we're not talking about common land or the council leasing us land. We do have the right under allotment law to have, and it's not just about growing food, Tony, it's about mental health and well-being, people that don't have, you know, access to...
Well, it's the sort of stuff Crispin was saying. This is a community here, isn't it?
And also, because once you start to get to know about all the volunteers that work for the community orchards and gardens that help people with Alzheimer's, with people with mental health issues, and about just taking back control over what actually is, it belongs to us. And so, in actual fact, the allotments movement is indicative of, you know, how we are preserving things, and janitors and caretakers for the next generation. And I think the same for the Labour Party. I'm no longer a member of the Labour Party. I do know people that are still there, and we're waiting for the time to come again, and it'll come through the next generation, the young ones.
Well, BlackRock might not agree with it, but the Earth is a free gift to mankind, whether they like it or not. So let's hear from Crispin, finally. Thanks so much for joining us,
and
Mal.
Thank you for having me.
And are you on social media and things like that? So if people want to follow what you're up to?
No, I'm not. I'm not like a general...
Neither is Crispin, no.
Crispin,
well, actually, no, I think he is. Who else was it? Oh, it's Stephen Dorrell, that's right, who we just heard from. He says, no, I just do books. I'm not on any social media at all. So if you want to find out what I'm up to, buy a book.
Interesting.
And his next one is going to be on the Wilson plot. But anyway, thanks ever so much for joining us, Mal Sainsbury.
Thank you.
Okay, so the mobsters. This is the Crumb Snatchers. This is a poem this week from Patrizia, looking at the Rachel Reeves, the wonderful Ms. Reeves. The mobsters on the rob again, stealing crumbs from those in pain, the old, the ill, those dying too. They have no heart, this thieving crew. The old in cold sit every day, no food, no hope this life to stay, worked all their lives now on the heap, scrap wood for greaves, hack ratchet deep. Smarmer bloated smirks on the bench, MPs a smell far worse than stench. Chavvy, savvy, thieving crew who steal our crumbs, 'tis what they do. Our money laundered at Zell's the place, sneer smarmer, smirk, see on his face. 3 billion plus for white powder sniffer, why people here all starve and shiver. Pay rise for slobs on wooden bench, oh what fun for men of hench. Heartless, greedy, soulless too, each one a puppet, this much is true. Lockstep in words, in deeds, in greed, on weak and old, watch them feed. Money found for wars and trash, but for our sick and poor, they bash. They make folk sick with poison jabs, through COVID years they made folk mad, twisted rotten through to the core, each mobster worse, each one a poor. Pray God, step in, and justice see, for each hoodlum wrapped in perjury. Thanks, Patricia. And we're going to finally hear from Crispin and his thoughts about light at the end of the tunnel too.
I can only look at back at history and say that, you know, there's been worse situations than this and we've come out of them. And I think that, I mean, I believe that there is a kind of force of nature that does save us sometimes from those people who are destroying us. They get their comeuppance. They do, because they get greedy. They start making mistakes. Let's look at 2015. They thought they'd nailed politics, but they left a tiny little chink in the wall of the citadel. And we all piled in when Jeremy Corbyn got on that ballot paper. And they had no idea what we'd do when we did that. They only have to make one little mistake and we can all get piled in again, because there's so many of us and we just need a little glimmer of hope and we'll be away. And that's really what it's about. We've just got to find a tiny light and really go for it. And I'm hopeful that will happen, because this, all these people who try and control us, they get complacent. They lose their sense of how big and important they are. And we can exploit that. I think we can exploit that. But it's, at the moment, it doesn't look very good, but I think maybe it will. I think that's about as cheerful as I can get, right?
Still, you did pretty well, Crispin, and it's lovely. I think people, it's so important to understand that we could go into these dark places, but we've always got to show some sort of way for folks to come back again.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more, while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grave. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Spending ends, relations give crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. His own. He just don't worry about nothing, 'cause he's got his own.
Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run? Who will stop your little game? We are the boys who will make you think again. 'Cause who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think old England's done? Mr. Brown goes off to town on the A21, but he comes home each evening and he's ready with his gun. So watch out, Mr. Hitler, you have met your match in us. If you think you can crush us, we're afraid you've missed the bus. 'Cause who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run? We are the boys who will stop your little game. We are the boys who will make you think again. 'Cause who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think old England is done?
We'd like to tell you a story about a young girl, about 18 years old, about 5'2", and about to go out. Now her mother, realizing it was her first time out with a young man, called her into the bedroom and said, "Minnie, you're all dressed up in your finery, your very best clothes, and you look beautiful. You're gorgeous. You're alluring."
"Looks swell, baby."
"And now, Minnie, I want you to remember everything I've always told you, and above all, I want you to be very, very careful."
But she had to go and lose it at the Aspen. She didn't take her mother's good advice. Now there aren't so many girls today who have one, and she never let it go for any price. They searched the place from penthouse to the cellar, in every room and underneath each bed. Once they thought they saw it lying on a pillow, but they found it belonged to someone else instead. But she had to go and lose it at the Astor. She didn't know exactly whom to blame, and she couldn't say just how or when she lost it. She only knew she had it when she came. They questioned all the bellboys and the porter. The chef appeared to be the guilty guy, and the doorman also acted quite suspicious. But he coyly said, "I'm sure it wasn't I." But she had to go and lose him at the Astor. It nearly killed her mother and her dad. Now they felt as bad about the thing as she did. After all, it was the only one she had. They just about completed all their searching when the chauffeur walked up with it in his hand. All they did was stand and gape. There was Minnie's sable cape, and she thought that she had lost it at the Astor.
John Lennon there, from the final album that he made, released in 1980, just before he was assassinated, shot dead in New York, not by Mark Chapman, by somebody else, because Mark Chapman was behind him. He was shot from the front, and that's from the album Double Fantasy, Watching the Wheels. Before that, we started with God Bless the Child from Billie Holiday, 1941. So we're going actually getting back to sort of almost like wartime stuff with quite a lot of the some music today. After that, then there was the Who Are You? Who Do You Think You're Kidding, Mr. Hitler? From Bud Flanagan, who was part of the Flanagan and Allen team, who were very popular in the second round, the time of the Second World War. But that was recorded, that one, especially for the Dad's Army theme, and that was recorded in 1968. I think Bud probably, I think he died later that year, actually. So that was one of the last recordings he ever made, especially for the Dad's Army series. And then we had Harry Roy from 1939, going backwards in time, sorry everyone, that's She Had to Go and Lose It at the Astor, which is by far the best version of that song, which the Americans released various versions of that, not very good at all. And then finally, just before the we had to have a bit of modern stuff, didn't we? That was Hawkwind from 1975, Warriors on the Edge of Time, with their sort of rather, I think maybe Michael Moorcock wrote some of that, but whole Warriors on the Edge, I rather love it, sort of science fantasy mixed with a bit of Stonehenge music at the Free Festival. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. I really should go into what's going on with Ukraine. Martin, do you want to just say something about the latest in the negotiations? There's supposed to be a ceasefire. Trump says it was going to take 24 hours. It seems to be taking a little bit longer.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's been touted about in the Western media that there's going to be a ceasefire in the Black Sea. And what they've done is they've resurrected the deal that they already had, that, you know, commercial ships should be able to just go around in the Black Sea. You know, both sides allow their commercial ships to go backwards and forwards in order to get, you know, for example, that both countries can export their grain. But what killed that the last time, because there was a deal about this, is that the Western powers would not lift the sanctions on Russia's agricultural bank, which of course is important for them in terms of, you know, commercially, selling their stuff, and also in terms of insuring their ships and so on.
Hang on, can't the Russians just get around these sanctions by doing business through countries like Turkey?
Well, well, there have been, obviously, the sanctions are on, and there's been various runaround, you know, workarounds with that. I think that the Russians are basically just talking patiently to the Americans, and they say, okay, if that's what you want to do, well, these are the kind of things you'll need to do. And then the Americans go, yeah, but we can't do that. And the Russians say, well, we can't help you then. So in other words, that's the sort of stage this is at. The Russians, Putin, I'll say, are being very calm about this. If you want to talk to us, we'll talk to you. These are our conditions. And of course, what Trump wants is he wants a quick deal, so he can turn around to his supporters and say, "Hey, we've caused peace in Ukraine." Now, the Russians, of course, are not just going to sign up for a ceasefire because Trump wants one.
The Europeans, led by NATO, really seem to be on Britain. Seem to be trying to take over from the Americans, but they don't really seem to. Well, I don't know. They don't have the wherewithal.
Well, as Trump said to Starmer in the White House, "So you're going to fight them on your own, are you?" And Starmer said, "Ha, ha, ha," because of course we can't.
Surely the Russians are actually missing a trick here. If they were to do some deal for peace, this would completely turn the tables on Starmer, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but they're not interested in Starmer, Tony. Starmer's a minor person from those. They're interested in their global situation and relationship with the Americans. The British, they have got particular animus towards us because they see us behind a lot of terrorism inside Russia, which we can probably go into. But the fact is that they're not really that bothered about us. They don't care what we think. They don't want to talk to us. They're not interested. The US, they are prepared to talk to because they've got nuclear weapons. They could blow the world up. up. You know, they really do need to talk to them. And the Russian public opinion is quite clear that it wants Putin to talk to Trump. But also, of course, they realise that Trump's a chump and there's not a lot of deals to be done with him. But don't be rude to him for the sake of it. I mean, at some point, of course, he's going to find that he can't get what he wants, and like a pigeon playing chess, he's going to knock all the pieces over. The Russians are just it's up to you if you want to do that.
Powwow yesterday on Ukraine over in Paris, wasn't there? Macron says not all Europeans can agree. This is the same story. Ever since the White House, the Oval Office confrontation between Trump and Zelensky, we've had the same headline in different kind of events. It's exactly the same headline. Not all European leaders can agree on sending troops to Ukraine. The British really, really want to. The French might do. And everyone else is saying, we're not really sure. So this is, nothing has really changed since the Oval Office confrontation, has it? But this is, this time it's Macron this week trying to get everyone together to persuade them to send their soldiers to Ukraine.
Well, I mean, the Russians just roll their eyes at this. They've made it absolutely clear from the get-go that foreign troops in the Ukraine will be regarded as priority targets.
Well, they're now calling it a reassurance force.
Well, who are they reassuring? I mean,
they're reassuring Ukraine that the Russians are not just going to come marching straight in.
Well, I mean, but they are. And the point is that the Ukrainians have lost, and if they negotiate sensibly now, the Russians will give them an off-ramp. But if they carry on fighting, they're going to lose, and they're going to lose everything. And, of course, the key to this is Odessa, because at a certain point, when the Ukrainian army collapses, the Russians will be able to just move into Odessa and take over the whole Black Sea coast, all the way to Transnistria, which they already control. Now, that is ultimately what the Russian general staff want. Putin is saying to them, well, I've got to talk to the other side, and, you know, the negotiation at this stage is we want all the four oblasts, which have already had a referendum, to join the Russian Federation. And if you do a deal with us now, we'll stop there. But if you don't do a deal with us now, then we're going to take the other bits of the Ukraine, which are Russian-speaking, including Odessa,
right,
which
so
is strategic.
The big thing at the moment seems to be this business of the Black Sea, a truce in the Black Sea. We've got this truce with big power stations and electricity.
No, it hasn't. None of these truces are working. In actual practice, everybody's still fighting. So, because the conditions for these two different truces, the energy infrastructure truce and the Black Sea commercial truce, is that the Ukrainians have to actually sign up to them. And far from signing up to them, they've actually done everything they can to sabotage it with the help of the British. So the British are encouraging the Ukrainians, well, why don't you just fire a rocket at there? You know, because that way Trump and Putin can talk and talk and talk. But if you're still firing rockets at their oil refineries, then there won't be any.
This is what happened after Minsk, too, isn't it?
This is exactly the Russians. This is just deja vu all over again for the Russians.
So when there's a treaty, the idea is, and you're saying it's the Brits that are encouraging
yes.
us here, apparently, we are
the trouble.
The idea is that you just keep lobbing a few bombs over in order to, to show that you actually have no intention of really honouring
right.
your agreements.
That's right.
So this is what Putin means when he says that we're not deal ready, does it?
That's right. And if you think about it, there have been three deals to end the war. There was Minsk 1, Minsk 2, and then after the latest special military operation began, there was a further deal which the
Istanbul,
Ukrainians had signed in Istanbul.
Yeah.
And the British were instrumental in sabotaging this particular deal. The first deal was sabotaged by the French and the Germans, and the British were deliberately kept out of it. So the first Minsk agreements came from when Putin went to the Normandy landings commemoration, because we used to be friendly and he used to come to those things, and he had a word with Angela Merkel and Hollande, and said, well, why don't we cook up, sort out something?
There is something,
and keep the British and the Americans out of it.
There's something fascinating going on here, because it looks to me as if the Europeans, led by the British, are trying to keep this war going by encouraging the idea of bringing loads of troops in there, encouraging Zelensky to keep lobbing shells, to not keep ceasefires, that sort of thing. The end result of all of this is to make it less and less likely that Donald Trump is going to go to Moscow in May for the commemoration of the end of the Second World War.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. There's a lot of, I mean, it's not far away, but there's a hell of a lot to happen between now and then. I mean, world affairs are in a very, very, you know, fractious state. Lots of things are happening very, very quickly.
Do you think it would be a mistake for him or Vance to go to that if the war is still going on?
If there's a deal, that's up to the Russians to invite them and then to decide whether they're going to go. I don't think they're even invited.
This is all going on behind the scenes. They're not saying anything publicly about it, but it would be good for everybody if that happened, surely, except for those that want to keep the war with Ukraine going.
Yes, and that's why I don't think it's going to happen, because the war isn't going to end. So there isn't going to be a ceasefire. There isn't going to be a ceasefire in the Middle East, and there isn't going to be a ceasefire in Russia.
Mark Sloboda maybe was right, and back in 2022, maybe he was right. Great guy to follow, fascinating bloke. He said this is never going to end now. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, this is the website, is the Libertarian Institute. Russia says negotiations with US on the Black Sea truce are still ongoing. In other words, they haven't really managed to get anywhere too much yet. Zelensky has rejected the idea of removing some Russian ships and companies from Western blacklists. The idea of a ceasefire in the Black Sea, Russia is trying to impose its conditions on our partners, but these conditions are unrealistic. So Zelensky is vetoing the deal because he's saying that the Russian demand that the ships are removed from the blacklists, well, Zelensky's saying no, that ain't going to happen. So it doesn't look like Zelensky really wants a deal. And when he appears in public, I mean, I don't know if you've been watching recently, he's looking increasingly disconnected from the real world, and any kind of attempts to make peace, he seems to be scuppering. So his star seems to be really fading and falling quite fast.
Well, he is. I mean, because the whole, it's a debacle of enormous proportions for the Ukrainian people. It's an absolute tragedy for them. And it's not actually the ordinary people's fault. Don't forget, Zelensky was originally elected and he beat Poroshenko on the basis that we want to be a normal country. Let's just do a deal with the Russians, which implies that we'll have to give up some of our territory, and then we can just get on with getting a life. And that's what his pitch to the electorate was. And then, of course, he was captured by various forces, both internal and external, and he's now become a fight-to-the-finish guy.
So even in London, MI6, apparently they're saying, well, we're going to have to replace Zelensky. What do you think?
I think they probably are thinking about what are we going to do, because, I mean, you know, he's not going to go on forever, something will have to be done about him,
he seems to be losing the ability to actually come across as convincing anymore, which an actor has absolutely got to do that, otherwise what are they doing there? They need to replace him. And I asked you just before we came on air about Zeluzhny, that's who I'm hearing is the person.
Yes,
who
Zeluzhny was the head of the army. So he's a military guy, he's general.
He's very popular in Ukraine, apparently, because this is one of the things you need if you're going to be a leader, is the people in your country have to actually support you, which Zelensky's star has fallen.
Yes, and Zeluzhny was opposed to what Zelensky was doing, because, again, with British advice, Zelensky was doing things like the Kursk incursion, for example, the 2023 offensive, yeah?
Well, the great offensive.
All of which were for PR reasons in the West. They had no real military hope of success. And Zeluzhny, being a military guy, was saying, well, let's not do that because we're not going to win.
Well, eventually he was sacked, wasn't he?
He was sacked by Zelensky because he wouldn't go along. He was unhappy with the strategy.
But you can still see him around. He's doing bits and pieces.
Well, he's a Ukrainian ambassador to Britain.
Yes, he is, isn't he?
London.
He is. And he's been saying this about Article 5. Why is Article 5 important? We're going to hear for a second from him.
Well, in theory, in Article 5, if one NATO country is attacked, all the others will come to their defence. But in actual fact, the real wording of Article 5 says they will consider what they will do and they will do everything to help. It doesn't say that they will come to the aid of other.
So maybe he's actually right on the money here. So possibly he will be Zelensky's replacement. Let's have a listen to what he's got to say as well.
The Baltic countries understand very clearly that there is no Article 5, and there never was. Poland understands this too, where our missiles or Russian ones sometimes fall. Romania understands everything perfectly, but stays silent, and occasionally calls me saying, "Keep quiet." Well, two Shahed drones fell in your port. Why are you silent? Keep quiet, they say. And then, why did you turn on those electronic warfare systems of yours? They flew toward us. And I say, then shoot them down. You've got 40 F-16s standing by.
So there he is. He's saying, look, there's nothing really realistic about the, particularly the Baltic states. He's specifically saying there about this, that it's the idea is that this is something amazing cast iron thing that everyone has to stick to. But really, the independent militaries of NATO will just do whatever they fancy at the time. A bit like this whole business with now, you know, that NATO calling for unity over Ukraine and Britain calling for unity and everyone walking off except maybe the French.
Well, and of course, the other thing is, even if they were all determined to do something and they're all absolutely minds made up, the war is lost. It's too late. Yeah. I mean, the idea they've got that Rachel Reeves has got that we're going to massively boost British defence spending. Well, A, she can't afford it. B, they'd have to buy most of the stuff from the Russians, from the Americans, because we don't produce it. And C, in any case, it won't make any difference at all to this war, the one we're fighting now, because it's nearly finished. And the Russians have won. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah, so it also came up at Prime Minister's Questions, Ukraine, this week.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I join the Prime Minister in welcoming the delegation from Bring Back Kids, who are trying to return the tens of thousands of children abducted by Vladimir Putin, an act of pure evil? The Prime Minister will be aware that they've been working with the Yale University Humanitarian Lab, who were tracking thousands of those children inside Russia until recently. I say until recently because they've had their long-term funding removed. Will we consider using our existing contributions to the Partnership Fund for a Resilient Ukraine to restore that important work that they're doing, and in doing so, restore the hope that those children can be returned to their anguished families?
Prime Minister.
Well, I'm grateful to him for emphasising this again. Russia's abduction of Ukrainian children is sickening, and I think across the House we would all agree on that. A peace settlement in Ukraine must see Russia held to account and the children reunited with their families. And in specific reference to his question, the UK is playing our full part in international efforts, including funding the Bring Kids Back initiative through the Partnership Fund for a Resilient Ukraine. And I want to reassure the whole House will do everything we can to see these children returned and reintegrated as safely and as quickly as is possible.
Well, it's just a fact. I mean, the International Criminal Court, under pressure from Britain and others, said that Putin had kidnapped these children. So they didn't, for example, mention the Bucha massacre, which is one of the things they could have mentioned. Because in actual fact,
this is separate.
It is separate to that.
Let's just focus on the children.
Let's just focus on the children. Now, the fact, all that happened there was that in the Donbass region, at the beginning of the SMO, the local authorities and the Russian authorities said anybody who doesn't have to be here should go, because this is going to be a war now and we don't really need civilians here. It's going to be dangerous. And so lots of people fled. Millions of people have fled from the Ukraine to Russia from 2014 onwards. Yeah. Perhaps probably
in
more.
In fact, to all surrounding countries, especially to avoid the draft.
Yes and no, but in the East Ukraine, where most of the fighting was in 2014, people left because it was dangerous. The Ukrainians were just killing people at random. And of course, what the Russian authorities did was, we've got quite a lot of kids in care in Ukraine, yeah? In their bit of the Ukraine, which was now part of Russia. And the obvious thing to do is take these kids somewhere else so that they can't be injured, because there was indiscriminate attacks going on against them. And then the Western powers then turned this into some kind of kidnapping plot. And the rest of the world knows better than that. What the Russians did there was what we did during the war. It was called evacuation. Remember? When people just, you know, the kids were all sent off, their mums and dads were allowed to stay because they needed to work or whatever, dads in the army.
So they're taken to safe areas.
They're taken to safety. And that then is spun in the West as some kind of kidnapping plot. It's absurd. Everything to do with what people have been told about the Ukraine is, it's a kind of fantasy world. Yeah, where real facts about what's going on are completely spun. I mean, it's absolutely sickening. But 14,000 civilians were killed from 2014 till 2022 in the Donbass. 14,000 civilians would, they're just randomly bombing. What Poroshenko said, our children will go to kindergartens and have holidays. Their children will cower in basements. He said it. He was the president at the time of Ukraine. So their children will cower in basements. And of course, instead of cowering in basements, the Russians took them away out of the war zone, which is apparently a war crime.
Mm. Ridiculous, isn't it? With the latest, I think Putin literally, was it last night, I think, announced that he wanted to have some sort of UN force in there. Why is that?
Well, he was in Murmansk. I was reading his speech today. What he's doing is he's floating various ideas about how it might be resolved. And when
yeah, there's none of that from this side. No, it's all about how it can't be resolved.
Yeah, he was saying, well, the fundamental problem is that the regime now in Kyiv is not legitimate, because there should have been a presidential election in May, which Zelensky cancelled, and therefore...
Well, it's not very helpful saying that, is it? You've got to deal with Zelensky, mate.
No, because don't forget, the Russians want to do a deal with the Ukrainian people, which will last. So if they sign anything with Zelensky and then Zeluzhny comes in, Zeluzhny can just say, I'm not doing any of that. But if Zeluzhny's won the election... and Zelensky's out, then Zeluzhny will be the person that the Russians will say...
So is there any prospect for an election in Ukraine at the moment, then?
Not at the moment, unless the Americans put pressure on.
Mm.
They could. They could say, unless you have an election, we're not going to supply you with any more weapons.
Well, they're not supplying them anyway, are they?
Well, no, they are. They are. What's happened is that the deep state's got control of the policy. Yeah. And Trump may think he's decided it, but he isn't.
Is Trump been made to roll back, do you think, from a lot of this?
I think it was more complicated than he thought. You know, if he thought that the brilliant genius Donald Trump was going to be able to walk in there in 24 hours, everybody going, hey, Donald, we never thought of that before. Why don't we do what you think? Why don't we have our own show right here? But of course, it wasn't 24 hours. He's now saying he's going to have it done by Easter. I think it's not going to be done because there's too many obstacles in the way.
He probably does want it done for the May ceremony in Moscow.
Well, he would do. I think if it isn't done, he won't go. Yeah. What may happen is he's going to throw a fit because Putin is being very even with him, trying to string him along. You know, we're prepared to talk to you. But at a certain point, Trump may just decide Putin's a loser and he's not going to talk to him anymore.
So what's the plan with NATO then? I mean the UN. Sorry.
Well, the suggestion is that the UN might come in and supervise an election. In the actual speech Putin was giving in Murmansk, he was saying, well, this has happened before in East Timor, he said, and in the Congo and other places. And, of course, the UN troops coming in would not be NATO troops. They'd have to be somebody else. Mm. Indians, maybe. Indian army
whatever. Why not?
Yeah, but the point is...
Chinese.
The reason he's saying these things is to try and show that he's being reasonable.
Yes, that's right. He's actually looking to solve the problem.
But at the same time, I don't think he's got much hope that it's feasible, because there's just, you know, the hardcore in the West that wants Russia as an enemy, and that definitely includes Keir Starmer, are not prepared to compromise on anything.
When Zeluzhny, and this is why I've got a couple of clips from him this week, because I think he is likely to take over when Zelensky is, it seems at the moment he's being kind of trained and groomed in London to be somebody who can then step into...
That's right.
Zelensky's shoes. So let's have a listen to him now saying, this is from a couple of weeks ago, talking about the United States.
Maybe this is an attempt to revise the existing world order. Well, obviously, for Ukraine, it is very difficult on its own, albeit with the support of our partners, to fight against the axis of evil. But we have been fighting. And as the war in Ukraine were acquiring the characteristic of a global war, its results could have been predicted. And these results are obvious even now. As a result, the United States of America, China, Russia, and Europe have proved to be unprepared for such a global war of such a level of intensity. And for such a protracted war, the human and technological losses, it's obvious that the White House has questioned the unity of the whole Western world. And now Washington is trying to delegate the security issues to Europe without participation of the U.S. So we can say that in the near future, NATO likewise can stop existing. And a number of talks between the U.S. and Russia, Russia being headed by a war criminal, we see that the White House makes steps towards the Kremlin, trying to meet them halfway. So the next target of Russia could be Europe. The decision of the cyber command of the U.S. decided to stop any cyber operation against Russia. And the failure to qualify actions of Russia as an aggression is a huge challenge for the entire world and Europe in particular, because we see that it's not just the axis of evil and Russia trying to revise the world order, but the U.S. is finally destroying this order.
Well, so the US have joined the Axis of Evil. Gosh, how terrible.
Well, possible. I'm not sure he's quite saying that. He's saying the US have destroyed the world order. The Axis of Evil, this is, I mean, is this maybe just a cut and pasted from some MI6 Iraq war?
It's originally George Bush was talking about the Axis of Evil, wasn't he?
With Iraq and Iran.
And North Korea.
Yeah, it was with, around the time of the Iraq War, anyway. Yeah, the Axis of Evil. You just, I mean, I don't know where on this. It does smack of something which is London, MI6. And also, what we've had over the last few weeks is, if you, I did a sort of little search on Zeluzhny and his recent interviews. He's doing more interviews in the last couple of weeks in English. So I think the guy's being groomed, maybe.
Well, he has been groomed. He's definitely, you know, he's an MI6. Agents, effectively. And they, you know, if Zelensky is removed, and it's not clear how he could be removed, he could be removed by
election. Well, he may go, he may just be told to go. Right, well, we've got someone new out the way, please.
Well, he may just go. Of course, the Russians could actually just put a missile on him, which they could have done at any time, actually.
Well, they're not going to do that. They're unlikely to, because they know that he's actually a liability to the Ukrainians.
In other words, but they don't do that anyway, because they don't have a policy of taking out political leaders, because obviously you want to talk to them. You know, if you kill them, you can't talk to them, can you? You'll just have to talk to the next one. So that's, you know, they've concentrated really on military targets all the time. Now, Zeluzhny, of course, when he was a general, he would have been a military target, like Kirillov, who was assassinated in Moscow by the SBU, the Ukrainians, again, probably with help from MI6. And, of course, the Russian secret services are saying they think the British are behind the Crocus massacre in the theatre in Moscow. And people say, well, the British don't do things like that. I'll say, yes, they do. Do you remember the bomb attack on the Kerch Bridge, where there was a lorry, there was a bomb in the back, which had driven all the way from Armenia. The guy driving the lorry didn't even know there was a bomb in the back. Then it was when it was on the middle of the bridge, they blew it up. The lorry was wrecked, obviously. The guy who was driving it survived. It knocked a chunk out of the bridge, which took, you know, an hour, a few hours to fix for the Russians. But it also killed a 14-year-old girl who was on her way holiday to Crimea with her parents. And that was actually boasted about as a good attack by the Ukrainian secret services and their advisers, the MI6. Budanov, Zelensky, Zeluzhny. Budanov's the head of the SBU, and Zeluzhny used to be head of the army. And of course, the British have been very, very active in working. It may be the case that the whole Kursk attack was coordinated with the Ukrainian military and the British military, but the Americans weren't really told what was going on. Now, I think Britain has punched way above its weight in this war and all in the wrong direction.
So let's move across the world a little bit, because actually much of the action this week has been down in the Middle East. But before we get down there, let's go to Serbia, because there's been all sorts of accusations. There's been big demonstrations going on in Belgrade, and the Serbians have been using some sort of crowd control device. So let's have a listen. I think this is an Al Jazeera report about this. This is some sort of electronic wave that they send out into the crowds.
Me now is the Serbian ambassador to Britain, Goran Aleksic. Thank you very much, Ambassador, for joining us here on the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
What on earth happened? What is this sound?
Well, according to the statements of our government officials, the president, the minister of interior, nothing was used at that day. And to somehow make it clear to everybody, an independent expert were invited to come to Serbia to do a thorough analysis of these statements. And I think it's the best thing is to wait for the results of that and then to draw conclusions.
But Ambassador, I mean, if I look at the statements made on March the 15th, the Interior yes. Minister denied that the sound cannon yeah. was used on that day against mm-hmm. protesters. Mm-hmm. This was maintained by the President, who mm-hmm. said denial of even owning this actual mm-hmm. weapon. Then on the 18th of March, the Minister of Interior backs down on the President's statements, clarifying that the state had indeed acquired the LRAD-100X, that's the weapon, mm-hmm. while the President intensified the denial. So the President was denying that you even had the weapons. The Minister of Interior said you did have the weapons. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not the expert, but what I understood from the statement of the Minister of Defense, it was there is a kind of a loudspeaker which was which could be used to amplify the sound and the message to the crowds or to a place where we have to send the message. That was underlined a couple of times.
So you did use the weapon?
No, we didn't use the weapon. And I told you, we invited people, experts from other countries to come and to make an investigation.
But what we've heard from the government is you didn't use the weapon, you don't have the weapon. Then they backtracked and said, we do have the weapon, we haven't used the weapon. Mm-hmm. Then the Minister of Interior said, it's a technical device, not a registered weapon here, mm-hmm. or not registered here as a weapon. Our people haven't been trained on it, nor do they know how to deploy it to harm anyone. It's useful for our units tasked with maintaining public order and peace. Mm-hmm. As for the sound, it's only used to warn demonstrators to disperse. But even that has never been used.
Well, as I told you, I mean, exactly what I told you. I mean, he said that there is a device which could be used to send a signal, a warning, and so on. But all the official state officials denied using anything at the day.
So that's a, I think, Sky report on the use of this acoustic device, the LRAD, which stands for Long Range Acoustic Device 100X, which is designed to basically turn back crowds to make them go away.
Yeah, I remember Greenham Common women telling me when they were up there years ago that they would suddenly find themselves all feeling really, really sick. There was no sound or anything, but everybody just started throwing up. And they thought that was probably something from inside the fence.
Well, The Guardian says calls growing in Serbia for investigations into claims sound cannon targeted protesters. More than 500,000 people have signed a petition after a powerful sonic impact allegedly directed towards a rally in Belgrade. So there was about 325,000 people on the streets. And yet, apparently, the people who were there say that this weapon was used against the crowd. So, anyway, what's the political context of this? Is this happened or not, do you think?
Well, I'm whether it was actually happened or not, I don't know. I mean, it's possible. I'm not saying that the Serbian authorities wouldn't be capable of doing something like that. It's a very complicated situation. the situation in Bosnia Herzegovina is getting very complicated, because the West is trying to destabilize Serbia and Republika Srpska, which is part of the Bosnia Herzegovina, because it's part of their general, attempt to control everything. So Serbia is out of line, if you like. Vucic, who's the current president, he's the opposition to Vucic is coming from sort of pro-Western younger people, but it's also coming from hardliners who think he's too pro-West. So he's in the middle. So these big demonstrations you're talking about...
So a few weeks ago, we had the smoke bombs being thrown around in the Serbian parliament, didn't we?
Yes. And I guess the Otpor, of course, was the basis of Canvas, which is the centre for all non-violent, you know. So the overthrow of Milosevic's regime in Serbia was one of the first of the colour revolutions, yeah, where they pioneered all of this, you know, using social media and they used the clench fist as a symbol, yeah. That was a symbol of Otpor, and it's been used all over the world since then, yeah. So the current Serbian regime is in the crosshairs of Western destabilization, and that doesn't mean that people haven't got legitimate as always in color revolutions, that doesn't mean that people haven't got legitimate gripes with the government, because I think what started this off was a disaster of some kind, a train station or something like that, where, you know, these things happen, you know, where, and the same things happened in Macedonia, where there's just been a massive fire in a nightclub. And then on the back of that, you set off a whole, you know, the government doesn't know what they're doing. How did that happen?
Okay, well, getting closer to the Middle East. What about Turkey this week?
Well, again, that's another... What we're seeing is a result of the general crisis in the international system and in the economy is that all regimes everywhere are facing... You know,
but this is a crisis not within the economy in Turkey. It's a crisis in the central government, isn't it? Where you've got Erdogan, president, who's been there for such a long time. He doesn't want this guy who's the mayor of Istanbul to run against him, does he?
No, he doesn't. And he's from the...
Well, that's not on, is it?
Well, no, it isn't on. But on the other hand, what's underlying the discontent is that the economy in Turkey is in the tank. Yeah. And that's the same in Serbia. So you've got plenty of people who are fed up because their economic circumstances are deteriorating, and that is then the background for all of these.
Well, let's get
these struggles for power.
A report on that, one of the latest reports over the last day or so.
The Istanbul Municipal Council has appointed a transitional mayor after Ekrem İmamoğlu was arrested last week on corruption-related charges. More than 90 other people are under investigation, including journalists, business people, and municipal officials, placing Turkey's largest city at the center of a deepening political battle. But his arrest has exposed growing divisions within the main opposition Republican People's Party, or CHP. While the governing AK Party called İmamoğlu's arrest a legal process, critics see it as an attempt to sideline a rising political rival.
This case is based on secret witness testimonies and unverified claims previously seen in the media. It appears to be less about solid legal grounds and more about targeting Ekrem İmamoğlu, his close team, and senior municipal officials. However, we will soon publicly declare İmamoğlu as the CHP's definitive presidential candidate for the next election.
The party says İmamoğlu's detention has only galvanized his base, insisting his candidacy for the presidency will go forward despite the charges.
Eyes are now on the main opposition CHP party that is set to hold a congress on April the 6th, where it is expected to shape the future direction of the party and aim to strengthen unity.
But the voices from within the government say the real issue lies inside the opposition itself.
There is a serious factional conflict within the CHP. Özgür Özel acts like a political trustee, while Ekrem İmamoğlu dominates the party. Internal opposition has been completely purged. The PKK's disarmament, economic recovery, and Turkey's rise as a global actor after Bashar al-Assad's fall from power in Syria has unsettled certain foreign powers who are now attempting to redesign the country from within by transforming the opposition.
The government has also taken direct aim at the opposition's leader, challenging his legitimacy.
The CHP leader could not break free of the commands of the influencers to whom he owes his current position. He's made it very clear, especially with his behaviour over the past week, that he isn't fit for the position he currently holds and cannot fill the seat he's sitting in.
As Imamoglu fights to defend his political future from behind bars, the battle unfolding within the CHP may prove just as consequential as the one being waged in the courts, and it may reshape not only the opposition, but the broader balance of power in Turkish politics. Sinem Kösoğlu, Al Jazeera, Istanbul.
So it's a little bit like when Boris was mayor, say, or, you know, with Khan as mayor in London, that Sunak decided to arrest Khan. You know, now this is starting to get really rather serious. Do you think in Turkey, this is my take on this, is that actually the opposition party is much closer to NATO in the West than Erdogan. And so they're saying, well, look, we can't really stop this, but what we can do is we can stop Turkey being taken over by a more pro-Western, and more pro-EU, more pro-NATO, more pro-US military organisation.
Well, in 2016, there was an attempted military coup in Turkey, if you remember.
Well, don't they have a coup there around every 10 years? Yes. Maybe this is the latest attempt.
Well, what happens is the Turkish military is integrated into NATO structures.
I ask the question, do you think this is a kind of coup attempt? Do you know this opposition guy trying to take over?
Well, is it a coup attempt? What's going on in Serbia? Well, it's very confused. Erdogan himself is, you know, I mean, he's you know, he wants to be in charge, and he doesn't want anybody else to tell him what to do. He's very authoritarian. But of course, he was trying to be removed by the military, the Gulenists, because the West didn't like him, because he wasn't reliable from their point of view.
Well, I mean, that's certainly how I see it.
And he was nearly assassinated, yeah. But it was Putin who tipped off Erdogan about the assassination attempt, and therefore Erdogan owes his life to Putin.
The most simple way to do a coup is to pay the opposition to become much more onto your side, and then let them take over.
Well, I mean, you've got people in Turkey, you know, the sort of cosmopolitan middle class who don't like Erdogan and are more pro-Western than he is. So many of these people are protesting about this.
At the end of the day, the only thing that really matters here is, can Turkey remain in any way independent in the Ukrainian and the Middle Eastern conflicts? And the idea, of course, of the West is that they want them to become pro-Israeli, pro-UK, pro-EU, and anti-Russia, and anti-Iran, for example. But that's a very difficult thing to do in a traditional Muslim country. So that seems to me to be the tug of war that's going on here.
Yes, there is. That is one aspect of it, undoubtedly. It's as always, it's a bit more, you know, the closer you look at it, the more complicated it gets, the more moving parts.
But as you said, you've got these sort of, we were talking about in Serbia, these sort of Otpor type organisations, which are massively funded in order to encourage people to come out on the streets.
Well, that's right. I mean, Erdogan and his people are very suspicious about everything to do with things.
Is he right?
There was an attempted military coup in which hundreds of people died, and then loads of people rounded up and put
so
in prison.
So wasn't it a silly thing to do, to arrest this opposition guy?
I mean, what should happen, you know, in a perfect world, is Erdogan should recognise that this guy is his opposition, there should be an election, and let the best man win. But on the other hand, the deep state in Turkey, controlled not by NATO, won't want that person to win. And on the other hand, the deep state in Turkey, controlled by NATO, probably would want him to win. So what previously used to happen is that the People's Revolutionary Party, I can't remember what it's called now, Republican People's Party, used to be in power in Turkey. And when they tried to do stuff that NATO didn't like, the military took power in 1980 in Turkey, and they introduced the first International Monetary Fund Structural Adjustment Programme, which couldn't possibly have been pushed through with a democratic government. And then, you know, thousands of people round up, loads of people died in prison and all the rest of it. And of course, it's not something we hear about, because it was a pro-NATO dictatorship, and there's nothing we need to know about that, because that's just like we've got a pro-NATO military dictatorship in Egypt. But you don't hear anything about the terrible conditions in their prisons.
Well, the latest, at least in Turkey,
because they're on our side.
The latest, at least in Turkey, is that the journalists who've been arrested have been released today. There's also an interim Istanbul mayor has been appointed. But I mean, which way is this going to go? Do you think, is it can Erdogan keep control of this or not?
Well, I don't know. It's like trying to predict a very close game of football,
fair enough,
isn't it?
Okay,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, it's, what's also happening, which is very important for people to realise, is that Abdul Öcalan, Apo, as they call him, who's the leader of the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, he's being held in solitary confinement on an island off the coast of Turkey, and he gave a press conference a few weeks ago calling on the PKK to give up its weaponry and to join the political process. And Erdogan has encouraged this. But it's not, we're not there yet, because what's happened is that the PKK militants aren't prepared to hand over their weaponry just like that. They've called a ceasefire, and they said we'll only fight back if we're attacked, but we don't necessarily trust the government enough to hand over our weapons. But Erdogan is moving in the direction of resolving that, because he wants to actually extend his... He can't stand for election after the next time, so he wants to extend his right to carry on.
And oh, like Putin?
Yeah, yeah. So
maybe Trump would like
what
to do that
what
too.
Yes, I think Trump is thinking of things like that. That's right. But what he needs to do is he needs to get the Democratic Party on side, who are the basically pro-Kurdish party, which is all quite positive actually, because there's been a terrible conflict in going on in Turkish Kurdistan for decades now. Not one of the ones we hear about. Yeah, there are wars and things that we're supposed to be really, really concerned about. What about the poor children in Ukraine? But stuff going on in eastern Turkey. What? Yeah. So this is the way the media works. Propaganda.
Okay.
Certain things are important.
Let's move.
Other things you don't need to know about.
Let's move down to Yemen. Trump says he's going to be bombing Yemen for a long time. He's targeting the main civilian airport at the moment in the latest overnight blitz. Two have been reported killed by US airstrikes near the capital, Sana'a, and Israel has given the US intelligence for Yemen. So the Israelis are helping them.
Yes, I mean, this was, and of course we've had the so-called leak on Signal this week, where they were talking. I mean, at one stage, J.D. Vance has said, well, the guy who we think is in charge of their missile program has just gone into the flat of his girlfriend, and now the whole building is rubble. And they go, yeah, and they're cheering that on. Yeah. So in other words, to get one guy who they think, and of course they did it all by surprise, just as the Israelis did. Yeah.
So is it, how do you think that this journalist managed to get on that little... Did they trust him not to say anything?
Obviously speculation.
They trusted him not to say anything.
Speculation is going round that it was just a mess-up.
He was supposed to be an insider of some sort.
Or possibly it's not a mess-up. Yeah,
they trusted him. He turned the tables on them. Maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, anyway, at one stage he's only giving them. He's now released the full transcript,
which is clear,
why we know about
not
what
all. Not all journalists who are in the loop will tell the public what they know.
No, I think what he's done at first, he just tried to sort of make a deal about how that, you know, I mean, there is an issue. They're not supposed to be doing stuff on Signal. The reason being, A, it's not necessarily secure, as we've now found out. And B, of course, they're doing it on Signal because
the only reason we found out is because somebody who is in the chat group has just literally and pasted everything onto the internet.
Yes.
So it may be secure. I don't think we can
point is, you're not supposed to. This kind of level of discussion is supposed to be carried out on, you know, every embassy will have it, where, you know, you've got to use only our own internal mechanisms for this. And of course there's a record of all of that as well. So the reason they're doing it on Signal is there's no record, and it looks as if Trump didn't even know what they were talking about. So when he was asked, I don't know anything about it. Yeah, so there is actually implicitly criticism of Trump by Vance, for example, because Vance is saying we shouldn't really be doing this.
But isn't really, I mean, they've been quite clear, Tulsi Gabbard, etc. And if you look at these transcripts, which I've had a look at, there's no really sensitive information. This is all just embarrassing journalistic tittle-tattle that's on there.
It is, but at the same time, don't forget that
that
Goldberg was sent information about the attacks 2 hours before they took place. So if he was somebody who wasn't on the side of the government, he could have warned the Yemenis that they were about to be attacked, because they weren't expecting it.
Interesting, yeah. Well, that is a bit, that is a breach of national security.
Of course it is.
as if this is any of it, any Yemen is of any threat to a United States.
No, I know, but I mean, the underlying thing is they shouldn't be doing. I mean, of course, what Vance was saying in the conversation is, look, we're doing this for the Europeans. You know, there's 30% of European trade goes through the Black Sea, through the Red Sea, and you know, it's only about 3% for us. Why are we doing this? Nobody will understand what we. And of course, they're doing it for Israel. Yeah, and it may well be that this whole leak is to cover up the fact that they're doing it for Israel and make it sound as if they're doing it for us, Tony. They're doing it for us Europeans. That's so, why we're joining in, bombing Yemen, and we've killed quite a few civilians already, and RAF Akrotiri are involved in this. Now, RAF Akrotiri is full of people who are military personnel.
Okay.
And I would say, if I was a Yemeni and you've killed my children, we're going to kill your military personnel, and we want to go for the highest level person we can get, wing commanders. Yep.
Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Agrachi, Agrachi said on Thursday yesterday that the Tehran has responded to President Trump's letter proposing nuclear talks that was sent to the Supreme Leader Ayatollah al-Khamenei. Official response comprises a letter wherein our viewpoints regarding the status quo and Mr. Trump's letter have been fully laid out and relayed to the other side. The message has been delivered through Amman, which is a history of mediating between the US and Iran. Iran is leaving the door open to negotiations through intermediaries. Indirect negotiations, though, can continue as they existed in the past. So it's a bit of a... He's not really making a big fuss about this, because it does seem as if, similarly in Ukraine, that the Iranians, like the Russians, don't really trust the Americans to negotiate with.
No, they don't. But, of course, they've got to... The rest of the world is...
Iran is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
That's right. A nuclear non-proliferation treaty. Yeah, I mean, the obviously, both Russia and Iran... They don't trust the West to negotiate at all. But on the other hand, they've got a public out there, you know, people in South Africa, in Brazil, in China. You know, you've got to be seen to be reasonable. Yeah, there's no, you know, that's quite important. We're open to discussions, but we're not here to be pushed around, which is perfectly understandable. And of course, if you say we're not going to talk to you at all, well, that's, you know, people find that difficult to understand. There may be no point talking to somebody. All you're going to find out is you don't agree with them. But nevertheless, you've got to go through the motions of talking to them, because otherwise other people aren't going to understand why you won't talk to them. So, you know, you're in a double bind there.
Okay, so we're going to go into staying with Israel. We're going to looking at more investigative stuff now. Now, over the last few days, I've been discussing this with quite a few people over the release of the JFK file. We had quite a long clip from James Files last week, who certainly looks 99.9% was the actual guy that killed John F. Kennedy back in 1963. He was a Chicago mafia hitman who was sent down from Chicago to do the job by a guy called David Atlee Phillips from the Central Intelligence Agency, their controller. With him was Johnny Roselli, and Charles Nicoletti, also a hitman for the Chicago Mafia. And they certainly looks very much as if these were the people that actually did the job. But the question is, who was behind what the CIA were up to, and who was behind what the Chicago Mafia were up to? Well, Laura Guillenot did a documentary a couple of years ago. I remember the first time I ever saw it, I watched it on, I think it was on BitChute, and the next day I went back, and it had gone. It's like suddenly disappeared. So I would suggest, you know, it's all over the place now pretty much, but it's called Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers.
Jack Ruby is not the only element connecting Johnson to Israel. Far from it. In truth, Johnson had always been Israel's man. His electoral campaigns had been funded since 1948 by Zionist financier Abraham Feinberg, president of the fundraising organization Americans for Haggadah Incorporated, and a key financier in the Dimona Project. It is the same Abraham Feinberg who, after the Democratic primaries in 1960, made the following proposal to Kennedy, as Kennedy himself reported to his friend Charles Bartlett. "We know your campaign is in trouble. We're willing to pay your bills if you let us have control of your Middle East policy." It was also two strong supporters of Israel, Washington Post publisher Philip Graham and his main columnist Joseph Alsop, who finally convinced Kennedy to take Johnson as his running mate. Most probably, they blackmailed Kennedy with proofs of his adulterous adventures, of which Edgar Hoover, a close friend of Johnson, was well informed. According to Evelyn Lincoln, Kennedy's personal secretary for 12 years, quote, Jack knew that Hoover and LBJ would just fill the air with womanizing, end of quote. Whatever the real nature of the blackmail, Kennedy once apologized to his assistant, Hyman Raskin, saying, You know, we had never considered Lyndon, but I was left with no choice. Those were trying to frame me. They threatened me with problems, and I don't need more problems. And so it is that John was forced to choose Johnson as vice president by the Zionist network, despite the fierce opposition of his brother Robert. In 2013, Associated Press reported about newly released tapes from Johnson's White House office showing LBJ's personal and often emotional connection to Israel. An article from the Five Towns Jewish Times, running under the title Our First Jewish President, Lyndon Johnson, elaborates on that end. And after recalling Johnson's continuous support of Jews and Israel in the 40s and 50s, then his role in the crafting of the pro-Israel UN Resolution 242 in November 67, concludes, President Johnson firmly pointed American policy in a pro-Israel direction. In a historical context, the American emergency airlift to Israel in 1973, the constant diplomatic support, the economic and military assistance, and the strategic bonds between the two countries can all be credited to the seeds planted by LBJ. End of quote. The article also mentions that research into Johnson's personal history indicates that he inherited his concern for the Jewish people from his family. His aunt, Jessie Johnson Hatcher, a major influence on LBJ, was a member of the Zionist Organization of America. In an additional note, the article said, The facts indicate that both of Lyndon Johnson's great-grandparents on the maternal side were Jewish. The line of Jewish mothers can be traced back three generations in Lyndon Johnson's family tree. There is little doubt that he was Jewish. End of quote. The Jewish and the Israeli press occasionally refer to Johnson's secret Jewishness and often remember with gratitude his Israel-friendly policy. Whatever was the reason of Johnson's loyalty to Israel, it is a fact that, thanks to Johnson, Israel could acquire its first atomic bomb somewhere between 1965 and 67, and carry out its plan to annex Palestinian territories beyond the boundaries of the United Nations partition plan. By leaning on the Pentagon and CIA oaks, who had previously been bridled by Kennedy, Johnson intensified the Cold War and created the climate of tension which Israel needed in order to demonize Egyptian President Nasser and reinforce Israel's own stature as an indispensable U.S. ally in the Middle East. During the Six-Day War of 1967, Israel managed to triple its territory while creating the illusion of acting in legitimate defense to the applause of the American press. The lie could not deceive American intelligence agencies, but Johnson had given the green light to Israel's attack and even authorized James Angleton of the CIA to give Israel the precise positions of the Egyptian air bases, which enabled Israel to destroy them in just a few hours. 4 days after the start of the Israeli attack, Nasser accepted the ceasefire request from the UN Security Council. It was too early for Israel, who had not yet achieved all her objectives in terms of conquest. That is when, on June 8, Israel attacked the USS Liberty, an unarmed NSA spy ship stationed in international waters off Sinai.
They drop napalm and strafe its decks with rockets, cannon fire, and armor-piercing rounds before trying to sink it with torpedoes.
We had no way to defend ourselves, and it was just, we're just slaughtered.
We were just slaughtered. So that's an excerpt from Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers by Laurent Guillenot and Martin. What do you make of what you see? He mentions Dimona a few times there. This is often cited these days with all the hindsight that we have as one of the possible reasons why JFK was assassinated in 1963. He was trying to stop the Israelis. He thought it was a very bad idea for them to get nuclear weapons. A couple of years later, they had them.
Yeah, and I think Laurent Guillenot is a pretty accurate you know, I think the Israelis did have a hand in it, but they didn't do it on their own. Just like 9/11, they had a hand in 9/11. You know, we all know about the
They had friends in the United States, as they did in 9/11. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. And therefore, it, you know, there's a sort of a debate that goes on about whether the Israelis and the Zionists control the US, or the US is using the Zionists to try and control the Middle East. I don't think it's terribly useful. They're all just bad actors, and they've all got the same interest, which is to, you know, for them to rule the world, and for everybody else to do as they're told.
Yeah. So staying on the sort of US theme, we had an interview last week with David Whelan about his book about the John Lennon assassination, Mind Games, which is just a great title for such a book. This week, there was just a clip I was trying to find last week, but I just didn't have time to find it, which was, I think, a fascinating angle on it all, which is to do with Yoko Ono and her role in why, I mean, she was the reason why Lennon was in New York and had taken up residence in New York, but I didn't know all the sort of background to all this stuff. So, Yoko Ono, what was her role in, you know, did she contribute? Anyway, let's have a listen to what he had to say about that.
Wow, where do I start with Yoko? First thing I'll say about Yoko is I've spoken to a lot of people who work with her at the Dakota before the murder and after the murder. I've spoken to a lot of people who were around in the Beatles kind of era who knew her when she first came on the scene. And I've never met such a despised human being in all my life. They all absolutely despise her. Which is interesting. And the people that, you know, some people who knew her at the time were convinced, I'm not the fellow they are to protect them, because Yoko's still very much alive. And, you know, she's no longer running the estate, but they do have the Lennon estate does have a $1 billion fortune behind them, so you don't want to be messing around with billionaires. But what I will say is that a lot of people who knew her at the time thought she was somehow involved in the murder, which is interesting. There's no actual hard evidence for that, but there are concerning issues with regards to what Yoko said about the murder.
Don't a lot of people associated with John, might they not just simply be jealous of Yoko, who's kind of become his main attention?
So I can talk about one, because he's dead now, so he's safely away, and he won't mind me saying this, because he really didn't like her. It was a guy called Tony Bramwell. Tony Bramwell ran Apple Films, and I had a couple of conversations with Tony Bramwell when I first started this investigation. And he knew John when he first started to see Yoko, when she first came on the scene, and he basically painted her to me as a groupie. He just went after John for his money, and there is some evidence for that. It's scant, and it's kind of secondary evidence, but there is some people have said yes, she made it quite clear that she was going to go after John for money, because there was a contract that was put together with her husband at this time, a guy called Tony Cox, where if she did manage to snare John, any money that came to Yoko from any kind of inheritance would be split with Tony, and this contract was seen and verified by a friend of Tony Cox and Yoko Ono, a guy called Dan Richter, who was an actor. He was the monkey on 2001 A Space Odyssey. Remember, you know, the guy who throws up the bone in the air to start the film? That was Dan Richter. That's his claim to fame. But Dan hung out with the Lennons in the 60s and the early 70s. He was a good friend of the Lennons. And I spoke to Dan, and he told me quite straight. He said, yeah, there was a contract. He said, yeah, they did have a contract, but it doesn't mean anything. You know, she still loved him. But I thought, well, if you did a contract with your husband at the time, you know, for splitting any kind of inheritance with him from John's estate, that doesn't talk to me of love, to be honest with you. It talks to me more of business. And Tony Cox, her ex-husband, was a bit of a grifter. He was a bit of a kind, he had a bit of a reputation, you know, as a kind of film producer, inverted commas, who would get a lot of money for a film that then didn't happen to materialize. And Tony Cox is the guy who managed to kidnap, some people say just took away from Yoko her her daughter with him, called Kyoto. And Tony went to America in the late 60s with Kyoto and joined a cult over there, a Christian cult. And Yoko says that another reason why she took John to New York in the early 70s was to try and get Kyoto back, because she knew her daughter and Tony were somewhere in America, so she thought if she could base herself with John Lennon in New York in the early 70s with all of the Lennon power and money, it might help her get Kyoto back. And interestingly, she did get reunited with her daughter. I would say about 10 years ago now, and Kyoto is very much looking after Yoko now. Yoko's 92 at the moment, and she's got, I think, pretty sure she's got dementia. Last time she was seen at an awards event about 10 years ago, she was kind of babbling quite incoherently, and Sean had to kind of step in and kind of speak for her. So I don't think her condition has improved since then. So I don't think Yoko's got anything of interest to say about the murder.
So that's David Whelan I spoke to last week. The full interview, of course, went up on our show page, also up on YouTube and BitChute and various other Rumbles and things like that. I think it's a fascinating thing to try and understand why it is that the deep state in the United States or via Britain maybe even, or whoever, has decided that they want to take out John Lennon by remote control, by having some guy who's MK Ultra hypnotized stood there with a gun. Actually, the professional assassin is the other side of John, and it's not just this nutter who's used as a patsy for many years. And so, as a sort of tribute to all of this, because of course we're not just looking at the assassination, I'll be putting some of John Lennon's last songs that he did as a single artist after the Beatles on either at the end of the show or during the show in the next few weeks. But let's move on, Martin, to, unless you've got anything to say about that. I don't think you probably have you? Yoko Ono.
Not really, because it's too detailed.
Yoko Ono. This week we've had, or maybe it was last week, Mark Felton put a particularly fascinating piece up about this thing called Clockwork Orange, which is a secret military coup, he says, against the British Prime Minister. So let's have a listen to the military historian, YouTuber, Mark Felton's take on, we were talking, this is why I was talking, of course, to Stephen Dorrell earlier on about this. But let's have a listen to Mark Felton's take on the way that there was an attempted coup here in Britain.
In June 1974, a very, very strange thing happened in Britain. Heathrow Airport, then as now the busiest airport in the UK and one of the most important in the world, was suddenly invaded. In a fast operation, 400 British military personnel plus police began to isolate the airport, using armoured vehicles to set up checkpoints and roadblocks, while armed soldiers and police began checking vehicles and drivers' documents. The managers of Heathrow had not been forewarned, and soon one of the world's largest and busiest airports was basically under military jurisdiction. The official reason given to the press was that this was an anti-terrorist operation, the 1970s suffering badly with terrorist outrages globally. However, when news of this action, codenamed Operation Marmion, reached 10 Downing Street, the home of the British Prime Minister, it caused considerable alarm in the Prime Minister's office. The Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, had not been informed of such an operation due to take place. This was unprecedented. To Wilson, Marmion signalled that his fears, which had been growing for several years, were justified. To Wilson and others around him, it seemed as though the army was sending a signal to Downing Street. It was flexing its power to show how it could, if necessary, stage a coup and take power. Ludicrous though this statement may seem to us over 50 years later, the army's takeover of Heathrow Airport deeply concerned the government of the day, a government that was becoming very unpopular in some quarters. And
so this is, what's your take on all this, Martin? Does it matter that the army suddenly turns up at Heathrow?
Of course it does. I mean, the history of all this era is well worth digging into, because it explains a lot of what we're going through now. The deep state in this country is far more embedded than the democratic politicians, whoever they may be. And that's the lesson behind all of this. Wilson was ultimately removed. Callaghan was brought in, and then Callaghan, under pressure, goes to the International Monetary Fund and brings in all of the neoliberal policies which we've been rammed down our throat ever since. And of course the army played its role in bringing that about by threatening to carry out a coup, then removing Wilson, and then all this stuff is done under a facade. But the basic plan to do it all was is from within the deep state and linked to the US deep state as well, of course.
Yes, of course. So, well, also, Harold Wilson wouldn't allow British forces to be used in the Vietnam War, would he, either?
That's right, and that was that's probably what was the thing that triggered it.
Looking back at all of this, it does seem to me as if actually the British really wanted the British establishment wanted the British troops to be involved, but Wilson was actually pushing back not only against the Americans but against lots of powerful people here in Britain too.
You can imagine quite a few people in the British Army were rather fed up that they weren't allowed to go to Vietnam and die like the Australians and the New Zealanders. And we could have had our own little wall of people who died in Vietnam, but we didn't. And of course, Wilson didn't oppose the American intervention in Vietnam. He just basically said, "Well, we're not going. Sorry, we're just too busy. We've got other things to do here." But he didn't directly confront them. I mean, General de Gaulle was completely opposed to the American intervention in Vietnam. The British didn't directly oppose it, but they didn't send any troops. And so Wilson presumably thought, as long as I don't directly confront the Americans, we'll just try and, we'll try and just keep out of this. And, of course, it was a good decision. We didn't need the British Army to go to Vietnam. What for? Stupid. So they didn't go.
Interesting, isn't it? And as the Americans were taking over from the British as the so-called Western Empire, Wilson was saying, well, no, actually, we're not going to be doing what you want. Thank you very much.
Right.
So that's why I originally spoke to Stephen Dorrell this week to ask him about all this. And he pointed out that actually Mark Felton calling it Clockwork Orange, and by the way, I will put a link to the full audio of that investigation by Mark Felton, is actually wrong. It wasn't called Clockwork Orange. That was to do with Northern Ireland. But anyway,
With Colin Wallace.
That's right. Let's Stephen Dorrell explain that for himself.
Clockwork Orange was a separate, totally separate thing. It was a propaganda campaign in two parts, or three and four parts, in fact, in Northern Ireland. Firstly, to deal with the IRA and planting false stories, a false narrative. The second one, Clockwork Orange 2, was smear campaigns against politicians, which were mostly Northern Ireland, but included Labour Party people. And interestingly, we now know that in 1976, Wilson was told about Clockwork Orange 2. He knew about it. He knew that there was a smear campaign going on against him and some of his closest colleagues. And some of this material made it into the press. And it's part of what becomes known as the plots against Wilson, which were not solely MI5. There were people inside MI5, outside. There were people in MI6 and outside, and some military people. And some of the MI5 people involved in that, a small, very small group, were the same people who had been involved in 1968 in steering up stuff with Cecil King.
Now, we started by talking about investigative journalism. Was there much going on at the time into this, or was it all secret?
Not into this at all until what became known as the Pencourt File in 76, when Wilson tried to reach out to journalists and said, look, there's something going on here, and I need some help, and I'll give you the story, and you investigate it. And he tried the BBC, and he ended up with Barry Penrose and Roger Courtier, who were two young journalists. As Penrose told me, he said, at that time, we knew nothing about the intelligence services. You just knew that they were there, but you didn't know who they were. You didn't know what they did. Nobody had written anything about them. So they were starting from scratch, and it was very difficult. But Wilson told them a lot, which they put into a book called The Pencourt File, which in retrospect is great. There's lots of leads, lots of stuff there. The media in general tried to kind of dismiss it. The kind of opinion of Wilson had turned. He remained very, very popular with the majority of people, but people in the media, I think, started to think, well, was it so great?
So, similar to Jeremy Corbyn, you know, this is popular with the people, but the media didn't really like him and the establishment didn't want him.
Well, except that Wilson was able to become Prime Minister before all this was turned on him, whereas Corbyn never got the chance.
But so yes. Why does this all matter today, does it?
Well, of course it matters today because it explains where we are. The deep state in Britain has privatised everything, has destroyed the National Health Service, has created homelessness quite deliberately.
The deep state hasn't done this. That's the city, surely. The city,
the city and the deep state are overlapping, the same thing, overlapping yeah. things, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, okay.
When you've finished your job in MI6, you go to work for Hambro Bank, or and you know, if you're head of MI6, you end up running BP and all this sort of stuff. There is an absolute overlap between the deep state officials and if you're a general like Nick Carter, who's now involved with loads and loads of companies who are supplying weaponry to Israel, and he's making a good living out of that as an ex-general, yeah. And that's what happens.
What you're describing sounds quite corrupt.
Well, it is quite corrupt.
Quite fascistic, actually.
Well, there you are.
So it's corporations running everything, including political parties and the press.
Yeah, that's right. And it ends up with loads and loads of dead babies in Gaza.
So, cabbies. We were talking about Heathrow there. Just as we were coming off air last week, talking about the shutdown of Heathrow Airport, this popped up on LBC. This cabbie who worked at Heathrow phoned in.
Now to Europe or go on business to Europe, we are now considered aliens. We don't go through.
Well, that's
with
a whole different. That's a whole different. Nigel in Chelsea, who's missing the streetlights in Chelsea. Let's get to you, Dale in Westminster. You're a black cab driver who was in the vicinity of Heathrow last night, I hear.
That's correct. I was there at about 8 o'clock in the evening, sitting in the taxi feeder park, waiting to go down to a terminal. And on the board inside the feeder park is a list of taxi numbers to tell you when it's appropriate to go down to the terminal. And on that board, at 8 o'clock last night, there was a warning stating that there could be a potential power outage. So, to my knowledge, Heathrow knew that there was going to be an incident last night.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, what time was that, and what time was the incident flagged?
So it was around about 8:30 in the evening. So, way before the incident even occurred.
So was this a sign specific to the taxi drivers, or was this a general motorway sign?
No, so this sign is put up in the taxi feeder park. So there's a cabin that designates taxis and tells them when to go down to the terminal. And that warning was placed at 8:30. So the marshals that operate at Heathrow Airport knew that there was a potentially an incident going to occur.
The plot thickens. The fire started, it says, according to the news, at 11:23. But you saw a sign saying power outage or whatever it said in 8-ish.
8:30, yeah. Around 8:30.
What does that tell you, do you think? That they knew it was going to happen or it had already started?
It's a very big coincidence, isn't it?
Very interesting. Dale, thank you so much. Very quickly, I just want to read a confirmation bus text saying that, evening, Rachel, I agree with you about infrastructure. It's a joke, apart from T5, our airport.
So there we are, LBC, Martin, one of our competition channels. This sounds interesting. I mean, you know, he could be making that up. He doesn't sound like he's making it up. He's suggesting there that somebody, somewhere, knew 3 hours before that electricity substation suddenly caught fire that there was likely to be a power outage that night.
Well, it's just like Peter Power's
terror drill
on 7-7, where there is exactly the same tube stations where the attacks took place. That was in their terror drill. The same with COVID, where the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States told the Israeli Defence Forces that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China several weeks before it actually happened. When you've got foreknowledge like that, that implies complicity, doesn't it? Let's face it.
Well, he could be making it up, though.
Well, he could be making it up, but the police should be investigating. The police should be interviewing him and checking and going back and checking, presumably, if it's an electronic thing, they can go back and check what was up there. Okay.
What could possibly be the motive for taking out Heathrow?
What you do is you then suggest that we've got... It may be somebody...
You were suggesting last week maybe MI5, weren't
you? Yeah, but it may be, you know, because obviously what was being bruited around on the internet was this is the Russians getting back at us. Because, of course, we have carried out terrorist attacks inside Russia. The Russian secret services are saying we have evidence that a foreign intelligence service is involved in the Crocus attack.
Well, so maybe the Russians died. Have got some friends at the feeder taxi park and they don't want them to be annoyed by the power.
Well, I think the point is that the official story doesn't stack up. Presuming that you know what happened on the back, there's a various people who might have a motive for doing this. The Russians would have a motive, and in that case, they'd be sending a message to the British government, we can do this stuff, just like, you're doing this stuff in Russia, we can do it in London, stop.
Well, there's a couple of
because
biggies.
We've done it, but of course it may well be the British doing that, in order to then tell a story about we need more security, we need more money for us, blah, blah, blah.
A couple of biggies that have come out this week about all this. One is that the guy that was supposed to make the decision about whether to close Heathrow or not was in bed and uncontactable and asleep, and they couldn't get hold of him, so they had to take a default decision, really, which is, okay, we're going to have to close the place because the guy is supposed to decide it. We can't get hold of him.
Well, I mean, all of these things need to be investigated.
Well, that has been investigated. Now, this has been in the press this week, that he's been named. I'm sure, I'll put a link up to it on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. That's what happened. The guy who was supposed to decide, do we shut Heathrow or not, was uncontactable, and so therefore they had to shut it.
Yes. I mean, they're obviously knowing
a bit
what
incompetent, isn't it? Really?
Well, it's either incompetence or it's worse than that, isn't it? Okay, so that's what we're discussing here.
So the other story is that the airline associations are now they've said anyway that they are suing Heathrow Airport for all of the 300,000 passengers and all their aircraft because they have to pay for all these people, and they're going to be taking them to court. To get the money that they've had to pay for all these passengers that have been caused all this trouble off of the Heathrow Airport company, the private company that runs it.
Well, that's what they're going to try to recoup their losses.
Is Heathrow going to go bankrupt then, I wonder?
Well, it might do, in which case, you know, how's Rachel Reeves going to get her extra runway?
Boeing's going bankrupt, so maybe Heathrow could go bankrupt too. Why
not? I mean, what could happen very quickly? The stock markets have had a very, very torrid last 10 days.
I mean, is it sabotage? If it is sabotage, an economic sabotage,
could be economic sabotage. I'm suggesting an economic sabotage by the Russians to say to the British deep state, if you carry on doing stuff in Russia, we can do it to you. Or it might be the British deep state doing it in order to put the frighteners on the government. Or everybody's trying to claim that this is an accident now. Yeah. So that then begs question mark. But if anybody's got foreknowledge of something like that, that implies it's not an accident, doesn't it? And I mentioned the 7/7, I mentioned COVID, because plenty of evidence to show that some people knew what was going to happen with COVID, and they were all connected to the Western deep state.
Netanyahu being in London on 7/7, and amazingly also in New York on 9/11, isn't it?
Indeed.
Anyway, another little item. I noticed that we commented on this documentary. It's called The Privatisation of Nature, Buying Nature, Banking Nature, sorry, which was produced in 2014. It's absolutely riveting. It's all about how the financial system is trying to change the way it operates in order to put values on all sorts of things like areas of outstanding natural beauty and endangered species, etc., etc., and use it to make money and to bring about massive amounts of investment. It's a brilliant insight into it. It's about an hour and a half long, but I discovered at the weekend that this has disappeared off the internet. The only copy of it that was on YouTube or anywhere else had been taken down by the German channel that puts a lot of documentaries up there. So I managed to track down a copy and I've put it up in various places. So please, if you're able to, get hold of a copy of this and make sure it's available to people in the future, because it nearly disappeared off the internet, which is shocking for such a brilliant piece of work. This documentary was produced by for French mainstream TV, and then a few months later it came out with English narrator and subtitles.
The capital of the world is heating up fast, and we have ourselves to blame.
In-depth look
look at the problem of global warming.
Where water's getting scarcer and arable land shrinking.
It's now being claimed that we're entering upon a sixth mass extinction.
Earth, as we know it today, will cease to exist.
There is new information that reveals just how fast the world's...
What if economic and financial markets could save the planet?
We use nature because she's valuable, but we lose nature because she's free.
If we invest money in protecting nature, we'll earn very, very high financial returns.
Economists, bankers, investment funds, and financiers are taking an interest in the environmental crisis. They say that they can protect the planet their way, with money. How much is the beach that you visit every year actually worth? How much for the forest that you love to walk in so much? What is the value of a plant, a mammal, an insect? Does this combination seem at all unnatural to you?
Financialization equals to rape of the earth.
Endangered species and forests are treated like financial products. Can markets succeed where politics have so far failed? But at what risk? At what price?
Sometimes I describe the challenge that we have as the economic invisibility of nature. What I mean by that is that most of what nature provides is not transacted in markets, whether it's clean air or fresh water, or whether it's the pollination of bees for fruit trees. When did a bee ever send you an invoice?
So there is a little excerpt from that, Martin. This is a very powerful documentary, and it's explaining that as the old-fashioned, we want to call it that, financial system starts to collapse, this new digitization of nature, banking nature, is going to take over and save us all.
Well, obviously, it isn't going to save us all. What's going on there? I used to work for the New Economics Foundation when... Aubrey Meyer, the Global Commons Institute, he was putting, and he's not an economist, he was actually a violinist, I think, but he was putting forward this idea that what we've got to do is we've got to cap carbon emissions, and then countries can trade their carbon emissions. So the whole idea is, yes, there's an economic there's an ecological crisis, but capitalism can solve it, because capitalism is a fantastic system for solving any problem. So once we've defined the problem as a problem of markets, and we've created artificial markets in various things, you know, like enjoyable forests, which, you know, so you give it a price, then you can trade around all those prices, and speculators can trade, and therefore we don't need government planning to solve the problem, like banning trawlers that are destroying the sea. Now, we can allow trawlers to destroy this fish stock as long as they pay some money into a market which can then be used to create fish stocks somewhere else. So you can offset going on an aeroplane by paying somebody to build, to plant a forest on the other side of the planet. It's all rubbish, because if you want to solve ecological problems, the government has to intervene and control the market. You don't try and marketize it all, you try and protect it from the market. But of course, this is where the whole World Economic Forum, we need our new AI technologies to save you all from global warming.
Now, the new Economics Foundation was created by somebody called Paul Ekins. Yep. I remember seeing in Oxford a brilliant talk by him. He was a really fascinating guy that seemed to have a brilliant... This is the sort of thing that would probably make him turn in his grave.
Yes, I mean, I remember Paul Ekins. I used to go to things where he was at. It was Schumacher who founded, Small is Beautiful, who founded New Economics Foundation. But anyway, the point is that this is capitalist, imperialism. They want everything to be part of their financial markets. Everything. Insects. Air. Anything. Everything can be financialized, and everything can be seen in terms of us making money and tradable as well. Yeah. So carbon trading is really
just
important.
Looking it up, Paul Eakins was one of the founders.
Yes, he was. He wasn't the only one.
Just to make that absolutely clear. And that, I'll make sure that there's some sort of link that you can download an MP4 of that documentary, because it's absolutely stunning. It should be on the television. But obviously, the people that want that kind of world are going to make sure it isn't. So anyway, finally this night, this evening, we're going to have a listen to the report, which is a pretty shocking one. Now, I want you to listen to this. This is about online grooming gangs of various sorts and bullying gangs, and it's rather horrible report from ITV News. But in the context of what we know about the Order of the Nine Angles, this is exactly the sort of stuff that they've been encouraging. And yet, even though Yvette Cooper, back in 2020, demanded of the Home Office at the time, and she's now Home Secretary, that the Order of the Nine Angles should be proscribed and put on the terrorist watch list, this sort of thing. Apparently, no, she's forgotten about all that now. So, in the context of what the Order of the Nine Angles is, which is this satanic Nazi group which encourages people to kill people, and then that means that they can progress through their up through their kind of hierarchy of the order, this is all still going on apparently, but there's very little mention of that. It's a satanic Nazi group, would you believe? But let's have a listen to what this report has been coming out this week about online horror stories and crime going on and grooming. I mean, there's all sorts of implications of this in the context of the Order of the Nine Angles, because it doesn't get a mention.
Christopher was just 15 when he took his own life. He'd been lured into a dark web forum while gaming and subjected to weeks of blackmail and psychological torment by an anonymous predator.
They threatened him and they said, "We own you now, and if you don't do what we tell you to do, we shall kill your family." Ever since that moment, Christopher's life changed totally. He became a robot.
He was stopped from sleeping, isolated from his friends, and forced to watch gruesome horror films all night. It ended with a last message from his tormentor.
On that night that we lost Christopher, we picked up his phone and a text came through and said, "Are you dead?"
You do think I'm ugly?
I haven't passed judgment on either of those things.
The terrifying influence of the online world on young minds, especially young boys, explored in the Netflix drama Adolescence, is also sparking a national debate. And it's now followed today by a chilling warning from the National Crime Agency about the threat from online gangs of predominantly teenage boys who compete to be cruel, which has seen, they say, a sixfold increase in 2 years.
This is sadistic and violent abuse, bringing together cybercrime and fraud, but also child sexual abuse and commissioning violence across the internet.
The context is absolutely the misogynist influencing that these teenagers are seeing.
Among them, Kyle Clifford, who killed and raped his ex-girlfriend and then murdered her mother and sister.
I don't think that young women should be making their own choices about who their lifelong partners are.
And his actions, according to prosecutors, fueled by the violent misogyny promoted by controversial influencer Andrew Tate, whose videos he watched 24 hours before the murders.
I'm really worried about what is happening to some of our teenagers as a result of some of this criminal online activity. The National Crime Agency is making this a priority, and we are strengthening the law so that the organisers of these criminal networks could face up to 10 years in jail.
Boys are being radicalised online, say the National Crime Agency, and it's a trend that's deeply concerning. Sejal Karia, ITV News.
Okay, so that's a report this week from ITV. Back in 2020, UK's Nazi Satanist group should be outlawed, campaigners urge. A British neo-Nazi satanic group should be outlawed by the government as a terrorist organisation, according to a report from anti-racism campaigners. And also the Home Office has said this, they've sent this letter to the Home Office. But Yvette Cooper, too, has been weighing in, chair of the Home Office Home Affairs Select Committee said the Home Secretary should immediately refer the 09A to the government's prescription review group. And there's a whole quote from her there. Now, there's all sorts of implications here, Martin, with this online bullying, grooming, hate, etc. One would have hoped that rather than kind of recruiting these people as informers, that the police would be arresting them, shutting them down, putting them behind bars, etc. Because we've had, not only the whole situation with the Canadian Intelligence online grooming, recruiting Shamima Begum to go and her two friends who died as a result, going to join ISIS. We've also got this apparent online grooming of Axel Rudikubana too, who went and killed all these kids in Southport. So why do you think the government isn't putting two and two together? Maybe I shouldn't be doing that, but this is exactly the sort of thing that they're encouraging. Order of the Nine Angles.
You've got general misogyny and stuff out on the internet, and you've also got groups that are organising using the internet, and there's probably some overlap there. But I mean, you know, it's one of the things that may happen with all this moral panic about internet radicalisation is that you then say, and therefore we've got to control the internet, and we don't want shows like Tony and Martin where they come out with all this conspiracy theory which will might encourage people's minds.
Cause people to do the wrong thing.
That's right.
So yes, maybe this is the whole thing is actually deliberate. So these kind of organisations are quietly being encouraged by MI5 and by the Home Office in order for them to have either informers, recruits. And when we've seen that the security services have done this in the past many times, actually using mentally ill people who are actually rather sick as their informants and their agents.
That's right. And don't forget, Al-Qaeda was created by MI6. So everything Al-Qaeda has done over the decades that it's been in existence, it was started off as an MI6 project. And of course, that's there, and the deep state in the West, the tech bros in Silicon Valley, they're deeply involved with them, with the CIA in fomenting color revolutions and all the rest of it. And that's the world we are in.
Time to wind up now. Just also to remind you, it's clocks go back late on Saturday night this weekend. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guest. And that is obviously Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to local Labour Party, ex-Labour Party social justice campaigner Mal Sainsbury, and to sound engineer Dave Bazenko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send interviews and story tips via the Telegram channel. That's the easiest way, the best way generally. And this show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. Do please make live recordings. So we've been streaming live from the Eastone Studios in Bristol on that stream, the talkradio.org.uk one, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know. I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Like I say, clocks go forward an hour on Saturday evening, and do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning when the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. I loaded 16 tons of number 9 coal, and the straw boss said, well, to bless my soul, you load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain. Fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Can't no high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. If you see me coming, better step aside. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. One fist of iron, the other of steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
turning volumes of sound. Into the blackness we drown. Round, round, and round. Round, round, and round. As we lay in our sleep, the appointment we keep. Down, down, and down. Down, down, and down. Only the rushing is heard. Onward flies the bird. Must we sink in our sleep? Down, down, and down. Down, down, and down. Round, round, and round. Round, round, and round. Round, round, and round. Returning volumes of sound. Returning volumes of sound.